boy, if you want to go for a ride, you pick the right night. It is going to get so weird around here tonight. Well, we've got a very interesting guest for you this evening. Athanasios Comic. And I even practiced this. Athanasios Komiansos is going to be joining us all the way from Greece to talk about his new book, Chronicles of the Future, the amazing story of Paul Amadeus Dinak. And this involves a phenomenon you may or may not know about that's known as walk-ins. And if you don't know what that is or what that term means, well, you'll find out as we go along tonight. What else? What else are we going to be talking tonight? A lot of things. This is going to involve time slips, the soul, reincarnation, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, possession, discarnate humans and others, and so much more than that. It is going to get really, really interesting. Well, let me ask you a question. You've probably heard of past life regressions. Have you ever wondered about going into a future life? This is just some of the things we're going to talk about tonight with my guest, Athanasios Komiansos. I can get it. I swear I can get this. All right. So that's going to be pretty interesting. He's going to be joining us all the way from Greece. And that's going to happen after the bottom of the hour break there when we get to it. And his nickname is Nasos. A lot of people call him Nasos. So maybe I will do the same since I'm already struggling. It was just rolling right off the tongue earlier as I was practicing his name. Anyhow, that's going to be interesting tonight. And I got a rather disturbing update about David Adair. He's out at the White House right now. He's out at the White House and is going to go on a hunger strike until President Trump speaks with him and has an audience with him. So I have somebody who's going to call in here to give us the complete story on that, although there's a few things I want to go over here. So we will get an update from someone who knows a little bit more about what David Adair is doing out there. And, you know, last night we were talking about doing a mass consciousness experiment, what with the fires going on in the West and the hurricanes in the Atlantic, and I wake up and find out there's yet another tropical storm. And this is just off the coast of central Mexico. This is Storm Katia, which I don't know if that storm has reached a category status. Last time I checked, that was still just a tropical depression. And we've, of course, got Hurricane Irma. We've got Hurricane Jose. That is three tropical storms right now in the Atlantic. And that is because it's hurricane season. So anyhow, I did get a wormhole message about the fires in the West. I got this from Brian in Vancouver, who said, please include BC when you mention the wildfire season. This has been the worst on record, with the destruction of over 220,000 acres. The news this morning said there are still, get this, I hope you're sitting down, 162 wildfires burning. And that is horrific news, Brian, but I think people ought to know about it. And when it comes to Hurricane Irma, last night, I don't know if you know about this, but last night, as Irma made landfall in Barbuda and St. Martin, the wind speeds were so severe, Hurricane Irma broke the instruments that measure wind speed. The superstorm is real, is a real concept. Hurricane Irma's winds are stronger than if you were to add up all the winds of the prior eight storms in the Atlantic this year. Add them all up, and Hurricane Irma is still stronger than all of those storms. And Irma's wind speeds are tied with the second strongest maximum winds of all time for an Atlantic hurricane, matching a 1935 storm in the Florida Keys and Hurricane Gilbert in 88 and Hurricane Wilma in 05. Only one hurricane, that would be Hurricane Allen in 1980, has recorded stronger winds at 190 miles an hour. But Hurricane Irma has broken Allen's record for sustained winds. Irma grew so powerful so quickly due to a combination of very warm waters, high levels of mid-level relative humidity, and vertical wind conditions. And Irma destroyed last night 90% of the Caribbean island of Barbuda. And the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda said that Wednesday night. And Barbuda is home to about 1,600 residents. And what I want to do now is just take a moment, because last night there was a guy in St. Martin, and he was tweeting out during the storm. And you got to hear this if you haven't heard this. Now, his name is Alex Wolfall. And at first he said, well, according to this, Irma hurricane will hit St. Martin at 8 a.m. when the eye passes over the island. And I want to give these to you so you can see just how quickly this developed. And as the kids like to say, it certainly escalated quickly. So here we go, 4:30 a.m., now in St. Martin, and buildings shaking and howling winds. Scary stuff, but still have power. And then he says, a couple hours later, well, evacuated, and everyone now is hiding in the concrete stairwell of the building. Noise of winds insane. Please pray this will end soon. And then a little bit later, okay, I'm now pretty terrified. So can every non-believer, atheist, and heretic please pray for me in San Martin as Irma 2017 is here now. And then it starts to get a little dark. He says, well, so what they don't tell you in a hurricane is how hot it is. I'm boiling. And that is at 0544 hours in St. Martin just this morning. And then he says, maybe my last tweet as power's out and the noise is now apocalyptic. This is like a movie I never want to see. And the next message we get from him, from Alex, is this: my God, this noise. It's like standing behind a jet engine, constant booms and bangs. At least the concrete stairwell is not moving. And this is the last tweet that we get from this gentleman who was right there in the middle of the storm. He said, still thunderous sonic boom noises outside and boiling in the stairwell. I can feel screams of things being hurled against the building. And after that, radio silence. And it was also said, radio silence in Barbuda as well, after the eye of the storm passed over. And this is what's heading toward Cuba, toward Florida, right now. Irma's final destination does appear to be Florida. And there's only 20 million people that live there. Now, Floridians are well aware of this. They're already getting ready. Gas stations have very long lines. Grocery stores have very long lines. People are making their plans right now. And the National Hurricane Center forecasts tropical storm force winds beginning to graze Florida on Sunday night, with hurricane force winds expected Monday. And we're still not quite sure, but there is a shift in the forecast track guidance that now puts the highest threat along the east coast of Florida and potentially into the Carolinas. And it is very frightening to watch this develop. Right now, I believe Hurricane Irma is passing over Puerto Rico and will pass near or just north of the coast of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and will reach the Turks and Caicos and the southeastern Bahamas by Thursday morning. And this is a storm. Oh, man, is this ever one mother of a storm. But Hurricane Irma does seem to be slowing down just a little bit. So anybody out there who's in the path of this hurricane might have just enough time to prepare. But I am not looking forward to the stories coming out of Florida after all of this is over with. Just looking at my updates here, it looks like Storm Katia in the Gulf of Mexico, expected to hit central Mexico, has been upgraded to a Category 2 hurricane. And Hurricane Jose out in the Atlantic, also headed our direction, is upgraded to a Category 2 storm as well. So that is pretty frightening. And if that wasn't enough, guess what? North Korea is now talking about, for the first time, they have revealed plans for using its nuclear arms for space-based electronics disrupting EMP attacks, in addition to direct warhead ground blasts. The official Communist Party newspaper, Rodong Sinmun, published a report on Monday on the EMP might of nuclear weapons. Those are their words. outlining an EMP attack, potential EMP attack, produced by detonating a nuclear warhead in space between 18 and 62 miles above the surface of the Earth. And again, in their own words from the North Korean propaganda, in general, the strong electromagnetic pulse generated from nuclear bomb explosions above the ground can severely impair electronic devices, machines, electromagnetic grids, or destroy electronic cables and safety devices. And we actually have a name of a person who wrote that. That's written by Kim Song-won, who's the dean of Kim Chaek University and of Technology in Pyongyang. And he continued to say, the discovery of the electromagnetic pulse as a source of high yield in the high-altitude nuclear explosion test process has given it recognition as an important strike method. Great. Just great. I'll be lucky if I have fingernails by the time all this is over with. Let's hope, like many, many other things, that this is just talk out of North Korea. It does make one want to go collect batteries and get a power outage kit together, which I think I'm going to start doing. All right. Well, I do want to get an update on what's going on with David Adair and what he's doing out there over at the White House. So I'm going to head to the phones and find out. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, hello. It's Dino. And what you're just talking about reminds me so much of what we all go through. We are a remarkable country in many ways and strong, and yet so we can be hurt so easily, just like an individual, so strong and can be willful, but yet we are also fragile as human beings. Mm. And this is why I heard David Adair. You know, I was lucky enough to meet him one time. I'd heard his stories, but when you meet the man, he is a very genuine. He appears to me, and a very strong-willed, just like we can be. And he's been on your show a couple of times, and we hear all the things he knows or things that he's seen, and it is confirmed that he is a rocket genius. You know, propulsion genius. So what, on another program recently, he talked about, yesterday, he was supposed to travel to D.C., Washington, D.C., and set up a tent. He's a veteran, and he asked everybody listening, he goes, I need to have an audience with President Trump. And I got to tell him some things. I don't want an intermediary. I need to talk to him directly, I guess, about some things he knows. I don't know if it's dark budgets or something he was told. And he said, if you know anybody in the media, he said, tell him that, you know, a Navy veteran is out here in a tent and really needs to talk to him about very important matters. And that's what he said on this program just a few weeks ago. And so number one, I think, as most of us who I think have enjoyed him on your program and elsewhere, and I've seen him at a conference, very caring individual, very intelligent individual, and I think we have to give him one of these group energy things. But also, if anybody in your listening audience knows any kind of a media person that they can call up, inform them that David is out there, because I'm really worried. He's strong-willed. You know, I'm afraid he might end up in the hospital. He mentioned that. He goes, I'm not going to quit. He goes, if I die, I die. And he's told many of us that he misses his wife who just died last year. And I don't want him to go that far, because I think there's a lot more he can tell us. So that's the information I have.
Wow.
Maybe you have contact information from when he was on last. I don't have it in front of me. What's his web page?
I don't have it in front of me right now, but a couple of things come to mind. First of all, yes, David Adair is one of the most sincere individuals I've ever met in my life. I just adore that guy. And if he's doing this, it makes me think that time is a factor. Otherwise, there wouldn't be such an urgency. So there's something he knows that obviously is ticking. It's got a ticking clock on it. Time is a factor. If he's out there and he's not going to stop until he gets to say what he needs to say, then this is very important information, and it's got an expiration date. Otherwise, he wouldn't be out there waiting the way he's going to. And two, the other thing that comes to mind is, yes, he is incredibly strong-willed. And once he's made a decision, that's it. This is what we're doing. And he's not going to stop. He is absolutely not going to stop. And he's doing a hunger strike. A hunger strike, yep. Until President Trump talks to him about what he knows. Did he elaborate at all on what it is that he needs to talk about beyond space propulsion or black projects or something like that? Did he elaborate at all?
Well, as you know, he's long-winded but interesting. And during the time I was listening to him on this radio broadcast, he didn't bring up anything specifically that sticks in my mind. But as I recall, it's what I've just told you, that there are some things he needed to tell him. Ironically, I think he was talking about shoring up our electrical grid, which ironically you just mentioned, and he might have been the one that put it in my head that said that's what North Korea would make the most sense. Why launch an atomic weapon that poisons and gets them killed? And when they could do an EMP and cripple whoever their enemy is, probably more than them, because you fly over a satellite over Korea at night, they say there's like hardly any electricity anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be one of the things he wants to talk about. I've heard some talk recently about hardening our grid, and he was talking on that program, I believe, about how, you know, some of our grid is like, you know, 90 years old. It's like, you know, it's real easy to take out. And that, what that would do, and especially in the big cities in our country, would be horrible. You wouldn't have power back on for weeks, maybe months.
And we are so dependent on it. You know, Dr. Bill Forstchen really can explain this so well. We are so dependent on our power. We're talking real devastation. And I'm starting to wonder, what in the world, Dino? Is this how the apocalypse starts? At this point, I'm wondering. And I really, God, I really hope that this is just talk from North Korea. But there's a part of me that thinks, oh, they say this kind of stuff all the time. And then there's another part of me that goes, collect batteries and get ready for the power to go out. And, you know, it's maddening because you just have to kind of sit and wait. And, yeah, if there is an EMP launched successfully, it's not going to be a week until the power comes back on. We're talking down transformers. We're talking fried wires. We're talking vehicles that aren't going to be able to run anymore. We're talking planes falling out of the sky. This is as apocalyptic as they come. And I don't want to see this happen. So it really makes me wonder, because the last time David Adair was this concerned was right before Challenger exploded.
Yeah.
And if he has made this decision to go out there and sit and do this until somebody talks to him, then something is about to happen. Or he's so concerned that he doesn't care about his life.
Well, you know, and let's get all the bad news out. As you were talking, I have my computer on. I got a news flash. The Hurricane Irwin is now bearing down on a Texas nuclear power plant. So this is what we're talking about.
You mean Irma and Florida?
Yes. Well, it said here, bearing down. It just flashed on my screen here. Let me see if I can.
Well, we got a little bit of time yet before that happens, but I was reading about that, and there are two nuclear power plants that are in the most danger, but those power plants are taking steps to power down, and they're very well enforced, and they're 20 feet above sea level, I believe. So otherwise, I would be warning people about that. But again,
they're not Fukushima, in other words.
Right. But again, Dino, we don't know what's going to happen. So there could be a disaster there. It depends on the winds. What happens when you get 200-mile-an-hour winds? Was the nuclear power plant built to withstand that? Does any of us know? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that is another worry.
Brought up, I've read it on the net the last few days, but has anybody brought up again that maybe there is something to HAARP, and maybe why, I don't know why they would do it, but what, whether they're manipulating these storms and charging them up. If you saw what was on the net a couple of days ago, where there was someone put out a chart from space, and it showed Harvey was getting, like, was going one way and then suddenly flared up. And I don't know why we would use it against our own country, except then as you get into conspiracies, they want to break some area down for some dark reason. Mm-hmm. Because we're having so many of these storms, you know, whether you believe in global warming or not, it's very scary. And to think, why isn't our, you know, grid hardened? And like you said, everything, unless you've got a Faraday cage around all your electrical equipment, you're down, you know. Mm-hmm. And
that's right. And there's going to be
supply.
There would be a serious loss of life. But, I mean, there were, I don't have it right in front of me right now, but, I mean, there have been multiple storms in the Atlantic and in the Gulf in years past. Don't get me wrong. I'm not denying climate change or global warming. I am concerned about that. But we're in the peak. This is probably today or yesterday or the day before, something like that. We are right around the absolute peak of hurricane season. And at one time, there have been five tropical storms in the Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, I know it's devastating and it's a horrifying thing to look at and see develop, but it's hurricane season and that does happen. But I wouldn't rule out HAARP, but I have a hard time with why do this to your own people. It just doesn't seem to add up to do that to your own people.
It doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't.
But what is the dark agenda behind it? But at any rate, Holick Bear was calling me. You'll let him talk. He's an electrical engineer. But I don't want to, right, these disasters should be top of the news. But I don't want them to cover up whatever David needs to do, because he had a reason for doing this. And I don't want him to get sick or die. You know, let's just keep it in the news stream, and let's just hope that, you know, something doesn't happen to him. Everybody out there, I know we love him.
Yeah, oh yeah, we certainly do, and I don't want anything to happen to him out there. I mean, I wouldn't want him to, I don't know, is he going to be sleeping out there overnight? Is he going to get a hotel room? What? But I know one thing for sure, once David Adair makes a decision, that's it. He's stubborn, and he's not going to give up until all options are exhausted. So it makes a person wonder what's on his mind. Also makes me wonder if I shouldn't give him a call. Another really interesting story. This came from listener Paul. Sent me an email. And, you know how when people talk about taking DMT, and they smoke DMT, and they go into this other world where there's beings, and they get in contact with these beings, and they talk to them and everything. And this seems to last for about 5 minutes. Well, get this. There's a man out there by the name of Egon Ehrenberg who has a company called NewNautics.org, and he thinks that these beings in the DMT world are real. And in fact, he thinks they're extraterrestrial, and he's starting a project where what he wants to do is build a machine that would cause a constant DMT drip for one lucky or unlucky cosmonaut to then go on a 5-hour DMT trip to make contact with these beings in the DMT world, communicate with them, find out what they want, what they're all about, and then come back to tell us all about it. And make no mistake, this has never been done before. Never in the history of psychedelics has this ever been done before. And I just wonder, because some people say that the creatures in the DMT world aren't real. Some people say they are. Well, we will find out. I just thought that was a really interesting project. And we got to take us a break here before we bring on Athanasios Komianos. Haha, I got it. And we're going to have a strange conversation about his book, Chronicles of the Future, The Amazing Story of Paul Amadeus Dinak. We'll be right back. Well, allow me to introduce you to someone you may have never heard of before. Well, you're going to meet him tonight. He's joining us all the way from Greece. Athanasios Kamianos, and that is confirmed. That is exactly the way you pronounce his name. Although his friends call him Nassos, he was born in Kephissia, Greece in 1964, and he moved to the United States where he studied psychology in Rose State College at Oklahoma City. Soon he moved into Oklahoma University, and he finally graduated from Old Dominion University at Norfolk, Virginia in 1985 as a sociology graduate. He had to abandon his graduate work and return to Greece for family reasons, but his interest in hypnosis and in-depth psychology was still with him until finally, after a very long and torturous detour, he came to practice it as a hypnotherapist at the island of Corfu in Greece. He was approved as a certified hypnotherapist by the National Guild of Hypnotists and as a certified regression therapist by the International Board for Regression Therapy. He was a member of the IARRT. He also has served at the board of the Earth Association for Regression Therapy, Earth, as a vice president from 2009 to 13 and president from 2013 to 2015. Now, since 2013, he has moved back to Kephissia, where he is successfully running his therapeutic practice. He is also founder and director of the Greek Academy of Regression Therapy. Now, he has published several articles on the Journal for Regression Therapy, as well as several articles on a Greek weekly magazine called Phenomena, and is the author of two books. Nassos is very well known as a deep researcher of the paranormal and parapsychological phenomena and has just formed a center in Athens where these phenomena are studied. It was due to his interest in what others call the metaphysical that he studied the Valley of Roses in depth. And of course, yes, I'll be asking about that tonight. He also was the first person to present this story, the story we're going to hear tonight, outside of Greece and in the English language. And what a pleasure and a treat and really an honor to welcome Nassos to the program this evening. Welcome to the show, Nassos. You want to tell him what happened over the break?
First of all, kalimera to all the Greeks in America who are listening to this. Kalimera means good morning. Here we have a morning right now. So you almost had a heart attack. You have to admit you almost had a heart attack because my microphone was not working.
That's right.
I hope
right.
Now you're listening.
Yes, we've got you loud and clear, Nassos, all the way from Greece. No, it was really funny because here I am telling everybody out there, you know, oh, this story is going to be so interesting. It's so weird. It's so off the wall and bizarre, and you've never heard of him before, and this is going to be so great tonight. And then the break comes, and I call Nassos to bring him on the air, and the first thing that happened was no audio at all. And then I heard him say hello, and I'm asking him, did I get your name right? And then no audio, nothing's happening. And I'm not even kidding, Nassos, I felt my body break out into a sweat. And I said, oh my god. Well, then Nassos said something. And he goes, no, I think I'm here. And by the way, this is a very bad situation to be in. I've had a heart attack, and I just started laughing so hard because here I am just, oh.
So you wouldn't really want to have one, I tell you. I promise it's not the best thing to do.
No, but it was really funny. Now that's going to make for a great funny story, you know, how you laugh about it later on. So it is very good. I can't even emphasize how good it is to hear your voice after that. And by the way, I did get your name right. So off we go,
yes.
Then.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, my name means immortal in Greek.
Very
so
cool.
It seems that the given name is here to remind me that I and all of us that we are immortal.
Okay? Yes, we live
and
on.
That nothing dies with death. Nothing ends.
That is part of what we're going to talk about tonight. I got your name right, but I did make an error there. Chronicles of the Future, the amazing story of Paul Amadeus Dinak. I hope I got his last name right there. You did not author that book. Is that true?
Yes, of course not. This is a very old book, actually. And it was originally written, actually, the author is Paula Madeas Dinah, and it is the whole collection of writings is are actually his diaries, okay, mm-hmm. back from the 20s, 1922 in particular. So we have his diaries that were given to his student who was taught German by him. And his student translated from the original German language to Greek. And then he published them back in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first edition from the Professor Papahadzis. And what I did, because this book was lost for many years, because the Masons got hold of it and they didn't want this truth to be revealed, so they just buried the book. They bought all the copies and they vanished the book. But the author tried again to republish it in 1979, only in 1,000 copies again, and again it was devoured and lost. So this was a forgotten work, actually. And a few years ago when I visited the United States, I thought it was about time to present this story to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a recording of that lecture at the ARE. It's the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the Edgar Cayce Foundation, you know, in Virginia Beach, on the other side of America. I think you are on Pacific side, right?
Yes.
Exactly. So it was in Virginia Beach. And I was invited by the International Association of Near-Death Studies. Virginia
cool.
Beach.
Very, very cool. I know a couple of people from IONS.
Yeah, they're wonderful people and very nice. They do excellent work there. So that was the first presentation in the English language, actually. And, of course, it is such a mind-bending experience. It's so difficult to share this story because we are talking about a voluminous book of 840 pages. It's very difficult and dense book to really get all the essence out of it. I've read it 5 times. Each time I read it, something new comes out.
Wow.
Because my mentality changes, things evolve, and other things are coming in, and you make new connections, new synapses.
Oh, yes, and that is the mark of a great story. When
exactly.
You, yeah, revisit it and get new things out of it every time.
And it's very difficult for me to summarize this book because when you summarize things, you do injustice to the original writer.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to start somewhere. I don't know, have you watched my presentation? Have you read anything from the book? Have you?
My producer wouldn't let me. She said that I've got to hear it live on the air for my reactions to be live on the air. So we're depending on you, Nassos, to tell us all about this. So, but you know what? I do want to make a comment about what you just said. That is absolutely right. And that's why this is such a long program. That's why we have 4 hours. Art Bell and his vision for a talk show was all about having enough time to really get into something. And that's what we have here. So we've got 3.5 hours. And if I have to delay taking phone calls later on in my night, your morning, well, then we'll do it. So start where you would like.
Okay. So let's try first to summarize for our audience and try to give a basic impression. We have 3 main persons who interest us. The first person is Paul Amadeus Dinah, who wrote the original diaries. The other guy who interests us is Professor Papahadzis, who was then translator of the diaries. And the other person, the other two persons are actually one person, Anna and Sylvia, are the love companion, let's say, of our Paul Amadeus Tinach, okay?
Okay.
So let's start from scratch. Amadeus Tinach was born in the countryside of Switzerland in 1884, okay?
Okay.
In a German-speaking family.
Okay.
But his mother was Austrian. When he was young, he moved to Zurich. He became a school teacher, and his first love, Anna, was forcefully married to a wealthy man and died 2 years after her marriage from tuberculosis in 1909.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In 1917, he had a fit of narcolepsy for 14 days, for 2 weeks. Okay? Now, that's an interesting fact here. He had another narcoleptic fit in May of 1921.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted for 360 days.
Oh, dear. And this is when you just fall asleep out of nowhere and you've got no control
exactly.
over it, right? Okay.
And now, there is an interesting note here, because in the book, the author, the translator, is talking about narcoleptic fit, okay, narcolepsy.
Mm-hmm.
He's not using a more well-known medical term, which was actually encephalitis lethargica, which was the disease of von Economo. Von Economo was the Austrian physician whose diagnosis of the disease was named after him. You know, von Economo discovered this disease and it was named after him. Encephalitis lethargica first appeared in the world back in 1917. Okay, and it lasted up to 1928, I think. Nobody knows the reason why this happened. They have no idea why it occurred, but it killed millions of people. Millions of people died, and the people who studied the case studies of that time, it was the most bizarre disease ever recorded in history. So, what were the symptoms? The symptoms were constant sleep, okay? People were in a trance, let's say, and they had several symptoms. The professor does not mention the word encephalitis lethargica. He instead says narcolepsy, which is the same thing, of course. But it seems as if he's unaware that the millions of people died of this disease.
Yeah, okay. And so am I. I had never heard that anybody could die from that.
Yeah. Thank God it didn't never occur again from that time on. Mm-hmm. So we don't have any other such cases recorded. But maybe you never know what will happen in the future.
Sure, and that is very interesting, especially from a paranormal point of view. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is absolutely interesting. So, the experts on the subject say that there were people who had been struck by this two times. So in our case, it's not it is rare, but it's not a big deviation. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay,
it's very important to keep that in mind.
Okay,
so after 360 days, he woke up again in his bed in May 1922 in Switzerland. But he only had a mother, and his mother had died, and he had no close relatives whatsoever. He had no one else to...
Oh, no.
So he's on his own. He wakes up. But Before I go into the core of the story, his immune system seems to be quite weak, and he's struck by tuberculosis. And it seems that his health collapsed. So the doctors suggested to him that he doesn't have a long time to live. It would be better for him to move into another area in Greece, where the climate is far more friendly for tuberculosis, and live the rest of his time in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So he moved to Athens, and he went and stayed right under the Acropolis. And it was exactly at the time when Greece had the disaster in 1922, where all the Greeks from Asia Minor, after we lost the war with the Turks, were forcefully, they were fled to Greece. So there is an overpopulated Athens with refugees, and this guy moves there. But he didn't have enough money to live with. So he started teaching lessons to young students of the university in German and French so he could make some money.
Because he'd been asleep for a year.
He sold all his property in Switzerland. He got some money, and then he came to Greece.
Okay.
But now, he decided that because his memory was very strong, he decided that he should write up his diaries, write them again. Now, that's the tricky situation here. Write them again? What do you mean again? Well, you see, when he woke up from his narcoleptic fit, he had extreme memories from something that seemed to be a life in the future. Okay? He was actually, when he woke up, he had vivid memories of having lived in another body in the future. We're not talking in the future of 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. We are talking in a future of 20 centuries ahead.
Wow. Good
it's
Lord.
As if,
so we're talking about the year, what, 4,000?
3905. 3905.
My God. Okay, now I get it. Why my producer didn't tell me anything about this. Okay. Wow.
Okay.
Wow, that's incredible. So this is while he was under his narcoleptic spell.
So he is in his narcoleptic fit here, and he's constantly asleep, but they feed him, you know, with a tube. They put something to him so he didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, but on the other hand, he is living in the future. I will go into the real story in a while. Let me finish with what he did when he was in Athens. He finished his diaries. He wrote them down. There are 4 books of them. Okay. And he handed, because he was feeling really sick, he left off to die, and he left them to George Papahadzis, who was his student in German. He left them there. And then he disappeared. Nobody ever saw him again. Now, his writing is obsessively romantic and full of lyricism. It makes really a very difficult reading. It seems his education was heavily influenced by the romantic wave of the 19th century, and it was so deeply embedded into him that he couldn't avoid it. Okay? So now, Professor Papahadzis has in his hands 4 diaries, humongous diaries. And he was given them, and he starts going through them. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes that this guy had this bizarre experience because he has memories from the future. It seems that this man, as he is reading his diaries, he understands that this man really lived in the future 2,000 years ahead. It was really strange. So he started translating those diaries in 1926, but it took him 14 years to translate them. It was up to 1940 that he was through with this. He became a very prominent lawyer and professor of law, administrative law. He became the rector of the Pantheon University of Athens. He was vice president of the Council of State. He was the founding father of the Philosophical Society of Greece. He was a top-notch guy. He was not just any guy, you know. Mm-hmm. And when he went into publishing this book, he actually played dice with his career.
Oh, yes, he did.
He really went down with it. He really disappeared with it.
Oh, no.
Because the system did not accept this book, as you can imagine.
Right. They're going to look at this and say, well, when did you get interested in science fiction?
You mean me?
No, they would ask him, who translated all the diaries.
Yeah,
you know, when did a man like you get interested in science fiction? Why are you telling stories, crazy stories like this?
Exactly. But you see, he never wrote anything other than, you know, scientific papers in journals. And all his books in the Library of Greece are all scientific. It's his only book which deviates from this, is this. Nowhere else is he did he ever attempt to write anything else other than his work. And actually, literally, in a literary term, it is a very bad book. You know, not good book at all. It wouldn't win the last prize in contest. It is, you know, it's just a diary, and a very boring diary sometimes. So it is not a book where you want to go out in a contest. Mm-hmm. You get my point.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I get the idea. And we're actually at a break point here, Nasos, and you have my full attention. Oh my God, this is so interesting to me. The fact that he was a scientific author and this got his attention, that speaks volumes to me, actually. It really does. I'm going to contemplate that here over the break, but when we get back, just pick up right where you left off.
Exactly.
This is so interesting, and a story that we are just getting wind of that most of us have never heard of before, and Nasos Kamianos is here tonight to tell us all about it. Did you catch that? A life lived 2,000 years into the future? We'll be right back. Athanasios Kamianos is my guest this evening. His nickname's Nasos. Probably call him that most of the night. And I don't want to say anything. I just want him to pick up right where he left off before the break. Welcome back, Nasos.
Nice to hear you again.
Yes.
Before I go on, I wanted to tell to the audience that if they are interested, the book is out there in English in a very short version, of course. But the essence of the story is there. And still, the people will have difficulty in putting things in order. You know, they have to read it many times to make sure that they can really get the essence of the book out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Chronicles from the Future, okay? And it was edited by Achilleas Syrigos, another Greek guy, who decided that this story has to be shared with other people. So let's get to the story, because I think we have been postponing this. for me, it is the most spectacular paranormal story that has ever reached my consciousness. So
that is a profound statement, Nassos.
Yeah, it is very profound. And the more I study it, the more it seems it must be true. You know, it cannot be how do you call it, a fake. It cannot be a troll. It cannot be something, the hoax. It cannot be, but you will understand why in a while.
Okay.
So, in May of 1921, our Swiss teacher, Paul Amadeus Dinach, I'm using the German pronunciation, he slept in a rare state of consciousness, okay, which was a lethargic sleep for almost a year. When he recovered, he came back with memories of another person. That future personality was a physicist named Andreas Northam, okay, who actually lived in the years 3905, 3906. I'm saying the time frame that Andreas Northam is keeping a diary there in the future. So the physicist now of the future had an accident involving a near-death experience. Okay?
Okay.
He died for 15 minutes because he had an accident with a flying machine. When the doctors finally resuscitated him, and he supposedly recovered, he did not actually recover because he had been possessed by the personality of our 20th century teacher. Can you understand that? Shall I repeat that?
Yeah. No, I think I get it. So our adventurer, Paul Amadeus Dinach, he goes into sleeping for a year. And then during that year, he seems to be living a life in the future of a man with a name. And then that man has a near-death experience and starts to experience Paul Amadeus Dinach's memories?
Consciousness, yes.
Wow.
He first had the accident, okay? The person of the future had an accident involving a near-death experience, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But when he woke up, he did not wake up as Andreas Northam, the person of the future, but he woke up as Paul Amadeus Dinach.
Oh my God.
Have you ever heard of that syndrome, the foreign language speaking syndrome, where people wake up from surgeries and they don't understand where they are, or they speak a foreign language?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. This could be a variation of that Suzak syndrome, as it's called. That could be very easily a variation of this, but it's a very interesting variation of this. So, in other words, when that person of the future was resuscitated by the medical team, he did not bring his consciousness was not brought back. Okay? It was Dinach's consciousness that woke up there.
My God.
Let's move on. Let's move on now. This is only the beginning. It'll become more interesting.
Oh my God, this is great. And you're right. Everybody needs to hear this.
So what happens then? Andreas Northam, the personality of the future, was driving a Linsen. A Linsen is a word from the future. It is a flying two-persons machine.
Okay. Like a flying car, something like that, small airplane.
Yeah, like a flying motorbike, let's say.
Okay.
Okay?
Gotcha.
It's an individual flying machine, but it can take also one person behind.
Okay.
It's like a motorbike. But he crashed. Then he was transferred to the Molsen Hospital, which was located in northern Italy. And he died, and he was immediately frozen, and then they tried to resuscitate him, but there was no brain damage. Now, we are talking, you always, our listeners have to always keep in mind that whatever we are talking about has been written in 1922. It is very important to keep that in mind, okay?
Yes.
We always have to go back there, go 100 years back.
Mm-hmm.
So he sensed himself in an alien and unknown environment. He suddenly wakes up and he says, where am I? What is this? What is happening? Why am I in this clinic? Why are those people over my head? Why are they looking at me? Okay, he's astonished by the difference in architecture, in technology, but he's dizzy. His mind is confused. And he cannot understand what the people are talking to him. They are people gathered over his bed. They are talking to him, and he cannot understand the language they are talking.
Oh, no. That's going to make it even more shocking.
Exactly. So finally he recovers, and he can walk. And when he stands up, he looks down at himself, and he says, oh, my God. Where's my body? This is, you know. And then he goes to the mirror, and he has a profound shock, and he faints. Because when he looked at the mirror, he didn't see himself. He saw another person. And he was shocked, and he fainted. It's as if I'm going to the mirror, and instead of myself, I see Donald Trump. You know, I would go up, down immediately.
Oh, sure. Female, geez, I mean, we have a heart attack if a hair's out of place. I would just lose it. I'd have my own year-long fit of narcolepsy if that happened to me.
Exactly. So, you see, he's in total shock. So, he starts speaking after a while when he recovers, and nobody seems to understand him.
Oh, no.
So they bring in, you know, all the specialists from the hospital. What's wrong with this guy? What's happening to him? Why can we not understand him? And then the doctors are calling in linguists to see what is happening there, and they realize that he's speaking an archaic Germanic language, which they cannot understand, but one of them is trying to speak to him in German, and he's trying to communicate with him, and it's impossible for this to happen.
Oh, because the dialect is so old at that point, right?
It's 2,000 years ahead. You can imagine how English, look at your movies back in the 30s and 40s, and look at your movies today as if it is a different language altogether. You know, the Hollywood movies. I mean, mm-hmm. You can hear a totally different accent, pronunciation, the same language.
Yes, we even have new words.
You can imagine in 2,000 years what happens.
Yeah, and the vocabulary is going to be different as well.
Different.
You've got different words that you use then, and in the future it's going to be very, very different. Okay, so I'm getting the picture here. Okay, go on.
So, what is happening to him now? He's so confused because you can imagine a tiny mind now trying to comprehend all this, and he thinks he's going crazy.
Sure.
Now, he suffers also from another ailment. After day and day goes by, they realize that this guy never sleeps. He never falls asleep. He's always awake. 24 hours a day, he's awake. They do all kinds of examinations and medical tests to him. They cannot find anything. He cannot sleep. There's no way he sleeps. So what we have? We have this 20th century Swiss teacher being asleep in Switzerland all the time, And the other guy is constantly awake in the future.
And
okay?
Somehow their souls are entangled in exactly. Some strange, unexplainable way through death, through consciousness, through the soul, or something that has overcome, you know, the vast expanse of time. This is just amazing.
In our, in my profession, in regression therapy, we call that a pseudo-obsession. In other words, when we hypnotize a person and we regress him, sometimes it may occur that a former personality of himself comes out and takes over for moments the body. That is called pseudo-obsession, you know, it's not a real obsession, it's not a real possession. Mm-hmm. It is because it is actually your own former personality that comes out. It seems to me that we are talking about this case. In other words, Andreas Northam, the physicist of the future, is the future incarnation of Paul Amadeus Dinah. It seems as if the former personality is awaking in the body of Andreas Northam instead of the personality of the future. Can you get what I said?
Yes. We've got a former incarnation that has walked into the future incarnation.
Exactly.
Okay, got you. Okay.
Exactly. It seems to me, okay, this is, we are not talking about hard truths here, okay? We are not, this is not mathematics. We are just trying to explain the case.
Mm-hmm.
And through the facts we have in front of us, that is what is the most plausible explanation for what is happening. So now, since the physicians of the future discover that this man is speaking a foreign tongue, they rightly say that this is a form of xenoglossy. Xenoglossy, you know xenoglossy, right?
I do not.
Xenoglossy is the ability to speak a foreign language without ever having been taught about this language.
Oh, okay, I see.
Okay. So you know, it's not glossolalia. Glossolalia or is one what happens in religious ceremonies usually, and people speak an language which is non-comprehensible by anyone. Xenoglossy, on the other hand, it is a language that you have never been taught, and you are able to speak it. Fluently.
Not as a result of an injury, but just all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is also recitative xenoglossy. In other words, you have heard a song or you read a poem, and you resuscitate. You recite it. You say it out loud, but you don't know what you are talking about, and there is responsive xenoglossy, where if somebody asks you something, you get the point and you keep on having a meaningful discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So they understand that they have a genuine phenomenon of xenoglossy. We do have such cases in the 20th century, by the way, and they have been thoroughly studied by Professor Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, there in America. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Excellent. Two books he has written on xenoglossy. For the readers of our audience here, they can look it up. So let's move on now. From the xenoglossy, we go on. He starts to be recovering. Huh? And the physicians decide that they have to bring in all the people that were meaningful to him, his very good friends, so that may trigger his consciousness to come up.
Right, right, to bring him back.
Right,
right, sure. Yeah. Trigger his memory.
If I brought you your husband, your daughter, your father, that would make things easier, wouldn't it, for you to rec- recall, to recollect, to come back.
Sure, yes, sure. And but this case really does intrigue me, Nasos, because I have a cousin who one day stood up from a holiday dinner, and that was it. She didn't know her whole family, didn't know her job, didn't know anything about her life at all, and had to relearn everything. So I have a personal reason now for being interested in this. I understand how these strange things can happen.
Did she ever recover, or she relearned everything from scratch?
No, never recovered. Had to relearn her entire life. And she met me twice, because I had met her for the first time right before that happened. And then after it happened, we had to meet all over again. It was really weird. So I know from firsthand experience.
Did you try to use hypnosis or altered states of consciousness to elicit the old personality? Did any one of you suggest to her to go to a therapist for this?
Her husband did, and I think her doctors did, but I don't think it worked. She had to relearn everything. Now, fortunately, what was really bizarre is that as she relearned her life, she really got a kick out of it. She was like, wow, really? This is what I do for a living? And this is my house? This is an amazing house. And this is my husband? Wow, he's pretty good looking. So it was really kind of amusing to see her relearning her life. This is my family?
Wow, you guys are cool. She will not get bored, you know.
Yes, right. So just saying, you know, firsthand experience, I can understand these strange things that happen to consciousness that we just do not understand.
We have no way to really delve into it and look at it. So that's really interesting because you can relate to the story now far easier.
Yes.
And so this guy was educated there in the future, exactly as your cousin did here. And they realize that he cannot recognize any of his acquaintances and any of his friends and loved ones. So they started to realize that something has to be done about this. By the way, they ask him to write down his thoughts in a paper.
Mm-hmm.
And his best friend, Stefan, realized that this was not the handwriting of Paul Amadeus Dinach. In other words, there was a different handwriting that definitely differentiated from Andreas Northam handwriting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's an interesting detail.
Yes, and I can give you a parenthesis here because there are some people who did some research in graphology and some experts on handwriting where they can make sure to check if one is original handwriting or not.
Mm-hmm.
They have a name. I don't remember now how they call them exactly, but anyway, when we had some genuine reincarnation cases where there were people who really discovered the former personality who has been reincarnated, one of the things that has been added into make sure to make the cross correspond, the cross checking, was the handwriting. And it was exactly the same from one incarnation to the other.
Oh, that's fascinating. But not in this case. Not in this case. So Andreas,
in this case here, we cannot check it because we don't have the handwritings of, you get my point. We don't have the manuscripts.
Yeah, that's a couple thousand years ahead of us, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So going back to our story now. They decided that they have to rehabilitate him. They have to teach him as your cousin has been taught.
Mm-hmm.
So they took him to a resort place in Italy, northern Italy, near the Lake Como. Lake Como is called Lake Como at that time as well.
All right.
But Stefan, his very good friend, and Geiger, his teacher, his mentor, take him there into the resort. So they accept that this guy is a man from the 20th century, so they have to teach him what happened in the 20 centuries that were in between. So they give him, they take him to a Reigensfage. That's a new term now. We don't have it here. Reigensfage. What is it?
Yes, what?
A Reigensfage is a special three-dimensional holographic chamber that was actually used as the basic means of teaching history at that time.
Now, there is no way a man from a late 20th century is going to understand anything about holograms or even invent that from his own mind.
Exactly. How could one in 1922 think of such a device? It's amazing because Reigensfage, he describes his first experience when he was taken there in a big city on the north. It's called Norfor, one of the mega cities of the future. He was taken into a Reigensfage, and you have to be seated, as in a cinema today. But, you know, you don't have to wear the glasses as we do here for 3D cinema. Once you stand there, everything around you is panoramic. It's as if you are in the movie, okay? Everything moves around you, jumps around you. You can hear everything, the bombs breaking up, out. You can hear the bullets in your you can feel and smell.
Oh, my God.
All senses are motivated. We are moving to this direction, but we are not there yet.
Well, right. We are, actually. That's what makes this so mind-bending right now. And I really don't want to take a break, but I got to take a break right now, Nasos.
Okay.
And we'll pick it up. Pick it up right here when we come back. This is, as it unfolds, I'm wondering how much weirder can this get? We'll be right back once again, everybody. Oh, what a groove that is. I couldn't pass up playing that tonight. All right, so America's Fall from Space. That's David Adair's website. Man, that has been bugging me all night. America's Fall from Space. And David Adair, if you're tuning in and you didn't hear this, David Adair has now parked himself outside of the White House, and he's going to stay there until President Trump speaks with him. Or listens to him. He's got information that he needs to give to the president. And so I want to ask all of you, just think about protecting David. Just think about, put a little of your consciousness onto the well-being of David Adair. I am concerned about him being out there, and I know he's on a hunger strike. He's not going to eat until President Trump gives him his audience, and so I just wanted to get that out there to everybody. Now, let's get back to Athanasios Kamianos, who's here tonight to tell us a fantastic, amazing story, and let's get right back to it. Now, Andreas is being re-educated on history in this holographic theater, I guess, to relearn his history. Okay.
It's not only a chamber, you know, or theater. They have Reigensfage for handicapped persons or home use. Like we have a tablet, they do have such a thing, which is holographic. In other words, it's a 3D holographic history teaching methods for kids, okay, or for people who are handicapped or mentally retarded. So they use these devices for them. So they have brought him one device at his home, since he's not sleeping at all at his room, they can provide, you know, he can all day spend in that way. He can learn the language and he can become acquainted with what is happening over there.
All right, so that makes sense.
Let's not forget he is in Molsen. It's, northern Italy, in a resort area. And with his best friend and his mentor. And they are trying to re-educate him. Now, I'm going to be moving back and forth because before we proceed, we have to keep in mind that Dinah's story, the guy from Switzerland, is the love story with his love, Anna.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
He was deeply in love with Anna, and Anna was in love with him. But because he was not a rich guy, because he was only a teacher, they forced her to marry another guy, a wealthy merchant, far older than herself. And she died 2 years after this had happened. She died after that because she couldn't handle it, and tuberculosis struck her, so she died. But if we read through his diaries, those two diaries from Switzerland, we will realize that they had secret meetings before she was married. And in their last meeting, they promised that they will have eternal love and dedication. And they went close to a village close to a lake. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And they had a secret spot there where they were putting flowers on their heads and they were making promises of eternal love. So now, when Dinah, through the body of Andreas Northam, met Sylvia, he recognized her as the reincarnation of Anna.
Wow.
You get my point.
Yes, so, I think I do. Yes, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And it was then that they fell in love again and concluded what had not been concluded in the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, this is the essence of the story, but now we have to go on and I have to tell you what concerns us most.
Okay.
Because as he's being taught about what has happened all these years, he's told that for the 20th and 21st centuries, very few things have been said to him. Even though he had interest in this area, not a lot of things were revealed of what happened during the 20th and 21st century. But what, in essence, I will tell you what happened. The dominance of the European continent, okay, with the imperial powers, the British Empire and the Dutch and all these, fall apart after the World War I, and the Americans are gradually moving into the picture and eventually take over by the end of the 20th century, being the leaders of the world economy. And at that time, they say that emphasis is given not in spiritual or intellectual matters, but rather on technological and economic development with massive production of products and an affluence unprecedented in history.
Sounds pretty accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. And while the standard of living is greatly improved for many of the people, the cultural improvements are conversely proportional. We have low-quality mass productions for the masses. Classic education, which was flourishing in the 19th century, is abandoned in favor of technical and practical training. So, during this dehumanizing period of the era of mechanization, the way of treating workers, even supervisors and managers, was degrading and inhumane.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the historians of the future realize that this is a really bad period for humanity. Okay? They call it barbaric times. We are barbarians for them.
Wow.
So, these people were always under the pressure, in real frenzy, where they were led by some people to psychic and mental diseases that even led to suicide. In that era of the New World Order, these totalitarian states were fighting over which tendency will govern, the right wing or the left wing, in terms of social control and conditions and all this. We see that all the day, every day, don't we?
Nothing but.
Yes, nothing but. We see the exchange of these two tendencies, but actually they are doing the same thing. They are only minor differences.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So the people that are valued in this time were not in the 20th century. Were not Goethe, Da Vinci, Dante, Pasteur, Einstein, Wagner, or whatever. They were other newly introduced idols. Okay? And I'm taking this expert right from the book. I'm reading it right out of the diary. Remember, it was written in 1922. It is very important.
Okay.
Comedians, dancers, those are the idols of the 20th century. Comedians, dancers, boxers, soccer players, ruthless Croesuses, escorts, and ragged, unclean, unkept, scruffy instrument players.
Oh my God, it's very accurate.
It's written in 22. Okay.
Oh my God.
Okay. You know, in the people who rule this society, actually, they see in humans only numbers, productivity, power and profit, and money and profit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing else that concerns them. And their view of the world was anthropocentric, geocentric, and had no value for other living creatures. Now, I think this is a very accurate portrayal of what we are living in today.
Yeah, you gave me chills when I was listening to that.
Yeah. So, now, back in 22, what is he writing? And please allow your listeners to note this down. In 2204 AD, humans managed to migrate on Mars.
It's going to take that long?
Yep. Maybe scientists are there, but the massive migration, you know, maybe scientists go there before to make settlements and build things and prepare everything. But in history books of the future, 2204 is when people managed to migrate on Mars. So they managed to build settlements and colonies on that planet. They managed to create the conditions for a bearable living. But that didn't last for long. It lasted only for 61 years. In 2265 AD, a terrible physical disaster took place that lasted for months and killed 20 million people. Only a few hundred managed to make it back and shared the story of the catastrophe. And the catastrophe was because they couldn't manipulate the weather conditions, and they couldn't stabilize the weather. So there was a collapse of the ecosystem, and that was it. That was the end of it, and that was the end of humanity trying to go elsewhere in the planet. System.
Well, 20 million people, and yeah. I don't know how many billions of dollars later, say we would learn our lesson after that.
Yep. So, let's move on. Another interesting thing from that time is the nightmare of overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists of the time did not foresee the time bomb of overpopulation. Even though, even now, you know, there are some scientists who are warning us that, listen, this cannot go on forever. You cannot have growth forever. You cannot feed all these people forever.
Mm-hmm.
We are getting too many on this planet.
Right.
But authorities, it seems, they say in the future, authorities did not restrict in time people from refraining child upbringing. And Catholic and Protestant churches did nothing to help to this direction. And suddenly, as if a flood took place, the situation got out of hand. And conditions were constantly deteriorating, and there were upheavals, wars, constant wars, and uprisings.
That's what you get when there's limited resources.
Exactly. And now, another strange thing happens. He's not talking about the West. He's not talking about the right wing or the left wing. He's not talking about communists or capitalists. He's talking about the white and the colored. He's talking about the white and the Chinese, as if there was a race war, which in our days, it's very difficult to comprehend how this could happen. But that's how it is written in the diary, so I have to bring the attention to you in that respect.
Okay.
So the white people demanded from the colored and the Chinese to restrain themselves from, you know, growing the populations.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, they were defending themselves that they claimed that they were mostly the victims. Okay, so the overpopulation had brought years and years of hunger and terrible conditions for the living and for the population. So then a series of wars started in which most of the time the whites dominated because they had superior weapons as to those of the others. But millions of dead people would not suffice to reduce the constantly growing population. That, I mean, even if there were a lot of people annihilated, still the problem of overpopulation was there.
Oh, my God. Well, that sounds
you
a
can
little...
imagine one thing, that I was talking to Achilleas Sirigos, the editor of the book that is in Amazon, The Chronicles from the Future. And I was talking to him yesterday, and he told me that he saw a projection by the end of this century, Nigeria will be 300 million people. Nigeria.
What?
I mean, America is 300 people. U.S. is,
yeah,
300.
We're somewhere
can
around.
Can you imagine that Nigeria will grow that?
No, I can't figure out. No, I can't figure out how you fit 300 million people
in
the.
They do have, you know, models that they build, and as they build these models, they project, and they usually are very successful on this. So. I'm not talking about India. I'm not talking about China. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that this is not far-fetched. It's not that implausible.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And we look at overpopulation right now, but no one seems to have an answer for it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they don't do anything to stop it. You know, come on, don't give birth to more children. Just cool it down. They don't do it. Anyway, let me tell you now what happened next, and this is probably the most interesting thing. The unavoidable came. You know, all this led to what we were expecting to happen years ago, but it never happened. But it seems if this story has any truth into it, it may happen then. Now, in 2309 AD, there was a thermonuclear war, a controlled attack which destroyed most of Europe as we know it. It was actually scratched from the map, and all of the world was scratched from the map. Only some Scandinavian people and some people in the Baltic countries were not destroyed. This war killed billions of people, devastated most of the continents of the earth, and it was the end of the barbarian times as we know them, as they know them in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then from 2320 to 2350, these Scandinavians and Slavs from the north start migrating slowly to the south and take over the old lands as these lands start recovering again and nature is finding a pace.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because of course they are on the lookout for resources as well, and if you know land is available, exactly. Well, go check it out, of course.
Yeah. So then, by 2394, they make the European Constituent Assembly, where they gather together and they decide that they have to change things. They repeat that a year after, where they make it the Worldwide Constituent Assembly. And 1 year after that, they establish the so-called, at the time, Global Rechtsstaat. It's a commonwealth with law and order. That's what that word means. And they set a new calendar at the time. They end prehistory, they consider our times as prehistoric and barbarian, and in 2396, they establish year one. Okay?
Wow. Okay.
And then they consider this barbaric era because our civilization was based on greed, profit, and private property. So no private property from here on. There is no way you will have profit, no matter what. This is not going to be the motive to move on with society. Profit led to destruction. Responsible for this shift in perspective was a charismatic political leader called John Tering. John Tering. Mm-hmm. Okay, I repeat that.
And I am taking notes all throughout tonight.
And his vision was to terminate human conflict and set the grounds for a peaceful era. And that is what happened right after that. That era now was called Pax Ecumenica Teringa, okay, after his name.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it's Latin. You remember the Romans had such terminology. So Pax Ecumenica stands for the World Ecumenic Tering. The language which is spoken is a mixture of English and Scandinavian.
Mm-hmm.
So a mixture of Anglo-Saxon and Scandinavian. So it's a very peculiar language. That is what predominates, and that's the official language. And that is how people proceed to the future.
These are very advanced ideas for somebody in the 1920s to be just making this up.
That's what I think also. Let's suppose that guy was a socialist, okay? The Swiss guy was a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And even he imagined utopia, a perfect communist state where everything is so nicely set up and nothing bad is happening. Even if he had so, he will see, if you read that book, and I highly suggest you buy this book immediately, dear.
I will. Trust me, I will.
Please do that. And when you read it, you will realize that this guy, this is not a joke. This cannot be a fabrication. And if you read it through and through again, you will realize this cannot be a fantasy story. And you will understand in a while why this is not going to be true. And this is not a fantasy of a utopian society or a socialist society. It's not the ideal communal society we are talking about. It's even more than that, and it has very specific details of how people deal with everyday life. That this is astonishing by itself. And let me tell you something, the guy who wrote the diaries went off to die. He never cared, he never asked his student to publish these things. He didn't care to become famous or anything. You know, he didn't want these to be published. He said, just keep them there. Do whatever you want with them. I just cannot handle them.
So he didn't have anything to prove. And that is also
exactly.
Very, very telling to me.
Yeah. Who would believe him in any place?
Yeah, right.
I mean, what was his motive? What was his profit? What was he after?
It doesn't sound like anything other than getting the material down and into somebody's hands and let them do with it what they will.
Yeah, so Heather, I strongly suggest you get this book and read it for yourself in a vacation if you have one. And it will take you a long time to go through it, I tell you. And that is one-third of the original book
in
Greek.
God. Well, again, we need to take another break here, and I don't want to because this is so incredibly interesting. But like we've been doing all night, I guess we'll just pick it up from right here when we come back, because this is so fascinating to me. And honestly, I think I need a couple of minutes for my brain to kind of dissect everything I have just heard. It's just mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And by the way, John T. Tighter, whoever you are out there, eat your heart out, man. I mean, this has really got that John Teeter story absolutely squashed. Just amazing what we're hearing tonight, isn't it? Do you think this is true? Do you think this man really saw a glimpse into 2,000 years of human history? He may have. I'm Heather Wade. We'll be right back. You know, I am going to have to get a copy of this book. And don't tell Arch, but I think I know now what I'm going to get him for Christmas. Welcome back, Nassos. Let me see if I can do this here one more time. Athanasios Komiansos is here tonight. I practiced this so many times, so it would just be roll right off it, but I am just... so don't tell Arch, but I think I've got to get him a copy of this book for Christmas. He is fascinated with time travel, consciousness, the soul, reincarnation, all of it. And if we're hearing about this story in English for the first time right now from you, Nassos, then Art has probably never heard of this. And I've got to get him a copy of this book, maybe even ahead of Christmas with a big bow on it, because this has got to be examined and dissected and studied. You know what? We really need to examine this man's accounts of the future, because this is way too detailed. It's way too on point for someone to have just made this up.
Exactly.
I can't get over that part of it.
Yep. It should not be confused with a prediction or forecast or with something we have reference in the past. Prophets, for instance, who foresaw things and talked about things like Nostradamus or Edgar Cayce. You see, Edgar Cayce made a lot of interesting insights and gave many interesting ideas, but actually he lost a lot of other things. He made a lot of mistakes in many other things. It's not a projection of my consciousness temporarily into the future, trying to guess what is going on. It's not like opening the blinds of environment and looking into the future. It's not a crack only in the future. It is a whole year living in the future. It's a totally different situation.
Mm. And I don't think I've ever heard. I've heard a lot of accounts of people going into the future. You know, Al Bielek went very far ahead into the future, but no story, not even fictional, halfway made up story I know of, goes this far into the future, this distant into the future, almost the year 4000.
I discovered Al Bielek, as you were talking about. I saw his interview 3 years ago. When I was presenting this in America, it came to my computer. You know, I ran into it, the story.
Mm-hmm.
Now I heard all of his interviews. Okay, now I don't know if he's a lunatic, if he's crazy, or if he's talking the truth. Whatever Al Bielek was saying is exactly what this guy is describing. The only thing that Al Bielek made a mistake was this. He said that they live in a socialist environment. This cannot go on forever. You know, how can that work? So he foresaw a collapse. But that was his personal estimation.
Mm-hmm.
Concerning what he described in terms of communication, in terms of transportation, for the century he was ahead in the future,
mm-hmm.
it was exactly to the point.
Oh,
not anything away.
God. Well, let me tell you a little something about Al Bielek. Mm-hmm. Art Bell, I think, was one of the first people to interview him. And in his day, Art Bell had, you know, between 15 and 18 million listeners a night. There are mm-hmm. major television programs today that don't have that many listeners. So the world, you know, our country got to hear Al Bielek, and Art Bell is very technologically inclined. He really understands technology, electricity, radio, all of these things. He's forgotten more of it than most of us will ever know. So he's mm-hmm. interviewing Al Bielek about his time travel adventures, adventures with the Philadelphia Experiment and all of that. And mm-hmm. he's asking Al Bielek very pointed and specific questions about the technology used. And that was one thing. Now, Art can't verify Al's stories about the Philadelphia Project or his stories about the future, but one thing Art could verify was the technology that Al described in great detail on his interviews. And I've talked with Art about this privately, too, and asked him, now, come on, Art, tell me, was Al crazy or what? Al Bielek is another one of my little obsessions. And mm-hmm. Art said all the technology that Al Bielek talked about, checked out, was real. None of it was gibberish. And mm-hmm. so if the technology, some of the crazy technology Al Bielek described, if that checks out and is very plausible and makes perfect sense, then what about the rest of it? And then to get another corroboration from you, I nearly yeah. just yeah. fell out of my chair.
Read the book and then put them together, you know, the interviews from Bielek, and you will see that in the period he is referring, Dinah is writing about, Bielek is totally correct. The difference in the phenomenon is that Bielek was there transferred physically as well, not only psychically. It was a physical transfer as well to the future.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
He lived there with his own body. So that's the difference between the two stories. It's not a possession of another body. It is his body that moved into there and came back.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting phenomenon is the time slip phenomenon.
Yes.
You know, where you physically enter into another point of space-time continuum. We do have such accounts, very interesting accounts.
Oh, yes.
So, but today we are going to focus on the story of the Valley of Roses and the Chronicles from the Future.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So, but this is very exciting to me to find out that Al Bielek's story is corroborated by something written in 1920s.
Yep.
That's amazing to me. My geek side is really showing here because that is, to me, that is more exciting than any blockbuster movie, any new album, anything like that. That is just, wow. I'm so blown away. Now I really get it. Wow.
Yep. We haven't started yet. You're only at the beginning.
Oh, my God. Oh, talk about going for a ride. I mean, I don't know about everybody out there, but this is very exciting for me. Okay, I'll get out of your way here. So we left off at...
No, not in my way.
2396, which ended up being year one, and we had our charismatic leader, John Tering, who surfaces in this time. Is that where you wanted to continue
and
on?
They set up the new frame of how things will develop for the future, so that humanity will never run into this self-devouring, self-destructive behavior again.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And this is after the barbarism of our time and a thermonuclear war and trying to go to Mars and all of this stuff. This is now after all of that.
It's over now. Now we go from history, and we go into the year 3905, okay? And I will try to describe and summarize for you guys exactly what was happening at the time in very short formats, but if you really want to go into the story, you have no choice but to get the book. Mm-hmm. So let's start from the place where Stefan and Geiger took Andreas Northam to recover.
Okay.
They took him to Kives Hostel. Kives Hostel. And sometimes they call it also Kivesheim. It's the the German or the word of the time. It's the home of the civilians. Kives, Kives is the Latin. Kives Hostel is the civilian. Kives are the people. I will explain what they are in a moment.
Okay.
Those hotels are for everyone, for all the civilians that have concluded their duty service for the state.
Okay.
Now, what is a duty service? The duty service is actually a mandatory employment for all youngsters from 17 years of age to 19 years of age.
Oh, okay. Sounds like what they do in Israel.
Yeah. They work for the state and they do whatever is asked from them. And they are called Yezels. In other words, partners. When people see them, they say, "Hello, partner. How are you doing?" You know, Yezel.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. They work wherever is need for them to work, and usually they work in Glothners. That's future terminology, as you understand. Glothners are humongous energy plants. Okay?
Mm.
They also work in Werkstätts, which are work sites, and they wear Trojas. They are special uniforms so that people know that these are Yezels. They are workers.
They are in service.
They are doing their service for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
What happens after these 2 years? They have a ceremony that they are free. They are called Kives, Sives, whatever. Kives is the how we pronounce it here. And they are free to continue their life with what they wish until they die.
Okay, sounds like a fair deal.
They work only for 2 years and they become retired after that. They can go have fun, they can go study, they can go swim, they can go whatever, they can travel throughout the place. They can eat freely whatever they want, they can order whatever they want. They live and enjoy life forever.
You mean they don't go and then have a career for themselves? You don't have to work? You don't have to...
If you want to have a radio broadcast, a radio show, you are free to do it. But that's your hobby. You don't do it for money. You do it because you love it. If you want to become a physician, doctor, or a professor at the university, you can become, after you have continued your service, and you can become whatever you want.
Mm.
It's free for you.
This is a very beautiful concept. This is a concept I only know from Star Trek, where, how does it go? The acquisition of wealth is not the number one concern anymore. It's all about bettering yourself, becoming a better human. And that's
exactly
what you're describing here, because all of your needs are met. You know,
precisely.
Because
they have solved the energy problem. You see, they have solved, you know, the way they use the resources in such a way as to have abundance for everyone.
Well,
there is no need for scarcity. There is not the elite and the masses. There is no elite. The elite is only spiritual. It's only intellectual. It has nothing to do with goods.
You know, there's an odd comfort in that, Nassos, because even though this is well beyond our lifetimes, to know that that's a possibility for mankind, it just gives me great comfort. It's a beautiful thing to know that may be our future. very far ahead into the future, but it might be.
That's a possibility, you know. In physics, the ability to overlap time and go into the future in terms of physics, it is feasible. Okay, mm-hmm. And according to the theory, there are parallel universes. So probably the Parthenon is built right now in a parallel, universe, and the pyramids are now built in another parallel universe. So and the future Paul Amadeus Dinah lived is totally different. So I really. It's something you and I, or even the best physicist in the world, cannot answer right now. But the thing is that we put it down, we write it down, we keep notes, and we wait for 2,000 years to see if this story was true or not, or if it ever became a reality. We cannot know from now. We are too way back to see
that's
that.
Right. That's right.
So, what is happening there? We are living in an ideal society, okay? And the Kivas can always be consumers of art, science, vacation, whatever they wish. However, the people who dedicate part of their free time and offer services to the others are considered very highly by the majority. You know, okay. If you offer a service to humanity, then you are considered a precious person. And, if you are a nurse, let's say, why should you become a nurse if you live in such a society? But it is encouraged by the society to do things for the other humans, to help them, to support them, to do things. And this is very highly regarded.
Not because a nurse makes a nice paycheck. In this instance, the nurse doesn't make a paycheck. Her paycheck is the satisfaction of serving.
Of serving a person to make him feel better and bring him back to health.
Mm. Well, okay. And I can understand why they would be so highly regarded.
Yeah. So in that society now, okay, let's see a bit about their economics. There is no private ownership.
Mm-hmm.
They have a statistical service in which they make sure that everyone has abundance of energy and everything is provided for everyone. Okay.
Okay.
Supply and demand are foreseen by the statistical service and not by the hand of Adam Smith. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That unseen hand of Adam Smith. No.
Right.
They have a statistical service which is working there to provide people with exactly what they need. And how the energy is supplied by the Glothners, as I mentioned a while ago. They are massive nuclear reactor plants that provide energy to all the planet. Now, this is important because we are talking back in 1922. There was not such a thing as a nuclear reactor. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dinah would have no idea what this is all about. You know that the Los Alamos laboratory there in the desert was a top secret. The Manhattan Project was a top secret project. No one knew of the possibilities of nuclear energy.
Right. And
only some professors in some universities were talking about that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
In the 22.
Right, but Dinah would have had no access to that kind of information. He would have no access to even theoretical information about nuclear reactors powering the globe.
Yeah, fighting with his, fighting with his narcoleptic fits and his tuberculosis and all, his love for beautiful Anna, he didn't have I mean, how could he have access to this information? You can get my point. There was no internet at the time, no scientific knowledge.
No internet.
No TV. Only radio, I think, was at that time.
Yeah. I mean, you'd be lucky to get a letter, you know. If somebody mailed it on one side of the country, you'd be lucky to get that letter, I don't know, in a couple of weeks. Getting a letter at that time was exciting. As exciting, you know, to us as Twitter is or Facebook is today. If you got a letter, that was an event in Denak's time. So all of the, you kind of get lost in his account of the future because it is so plausible. And then you forget, wait a minute, this is a guy in 1920 who's writing this down. Wow.
Writing this down. And they say, he says also that they use solar energy, wind energy, water power, whenever that is possible, but it is considered obsolete. They just have it there, you know, for sentimental reasons. Mm. The heart of the energy production, the pump, the real root of energy, is from the continent of Australia. That's what they use there. They have the big nuclear reactors there, and that's from where all the energy is pumped to the world.
Wow. Incredible.
It is incredible indeed. Then they have the food supply. Now, you see, I cannot explain in radio their denominations of the eras and the calendar years because you need to see this, you know, in a projection. You need to have a slide to see those. So it's very difficult for me to explain in words exactly what's going on. So I will skip this. But in the first few centuries of the old times, their old times after the barbaric times we are talking about now, the very first few centuries after the nuclear disaster, they resorted to genetically modified foods. Mm-hmm. That were mostly produced through laboratories of mass food production plants. And they resorted to more traditional ways of agriculture and livestock production to the years close to 3905. In other words, for at least 1,000 years, food was produced by industry.
Okay.
Because they had no other way to do it. By the way, I saw some people are saying, I've seen, you know, they take this story and they stretch it out and they, whoever wants, projects whatever they want on this story. So I read an article somewhere on the internet about this story that the people at that time are all vegans and they don't eat anything else. That's a bare lie.
That's an interpretation of the text. And I think in this case, it is so important to pay attention to just what's there, just what's in the text. Yeah. Don't let your mind wander.
To project things and put things there, you know, don't put pepper and salt if you don't. You may like it. It's a very nice thing to be a vegan or a vegetarian. It's very respectful and it's very nice. But no, people are not vegans at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because they have livestock production, and he says that he sees that all over the place wherever you go.
Got you. Okay.
Okay. So another interesting thing is this: that at the 40th century, there are no icebergs on the poles.
Oh. Oh, very interesting.
Okay, we are talking right now about the greenhouse effect and how it affects our climate. Only Donald Trump doesn't see that. But everyone else, I think you're suffering now from another storm that is coming your way. I don't know the name.
Hurricane.
It was Harvey last week, and now it's another one.
Now
right?
It's Irma. Jose Irma is behind Hurricane Irma, and we've also got a Hurricane Katia that's on the western side of the Gulf of Mexico right now. It's going to go in probably to central Mexico, and it looks to be pretty devastating. Those Jose and Katia are both Category 2s. So
exactly. They're quite devastating.
Yeah.
To say the least. Well, it seems that the projections that our scientists are doing today, it seems that this happened. Probably the temperature collapsed. The greenhouse effect melted all the ice on the poles, because there are no ice in the poles. But there are no deserts also. There is no Sahara Desert. There are no steppes. Everything is cultivated and inhabited. And everything is air-conditioned.
Oh, well, I just realized we got to take another break here, Naso, so we'll pick it up right there when we come back. Very, very interesting things we're hearing tonight. No caps on the poles. We'll also open up the phone lines here pretty soon, and we'll be right back. Well, if Danak is right, this song, very well could be the anthem of our times. And I'd like to welcome back my guest. Let me try this one more time. Athanasios Komianos is my guest this evening, joining us all the way from Greece with an incredibly interesting story. And, you know, when you were talking about our time being known as the time of the barbarians, that song instantly came to mind, because we hear that and we're like, yeah, and we kind of agree with that. But I think in the year 4000, 3900, how far ahead we go, they would look at that song as cruelty, as barbarism, as an example of our barbarity.
Yeah. Now, I would love to paraphrase that other tune of the 60s, in the year 45 instead of 25.
Yes, I so wish.
That.
Yeah, Art used to play
that. Tune?
Yeah, oh yeah, yes. Art Bell, he used to play that as a bumper, and I don't have it in my bumper catalog. I ought to add that. And I think it's in the year 25, you know, in our
we
arms.
We have to remix it and make it 35 or whatever.
Yes, right. No, exactly right. But it is so appropriate for the program tonight. I just had no idea. So we'll work on getting that into the catalog. But I think we left off at climate. Oh, and one other thing, Nasos.
Yes.
We open up the phone lines at about this time of night. And I haven't had very many calls tonight, and I was wondering, well, I'm starting to get messages from the listeners out there through, I have my own private personal wormhole over here. Mm-hmm. That's how listeners send me messages during the live program, and they are telling me that they are just entranced. So if we don't get a lot of calls tonight, I don't think that's an insult. I think people just want to hear as much as of what you have to say as possible.
Yes, because we have reached somewhere in the middle of the story, so they need to listen first to the whole story, then they have to sleep over it at least for a week or so, and then they will recover and they will start thinking about it. and they are entranced. Don't forget, I'm a professional hypnotherapist, so probably that's why they're not they're afraid to be hypnotized.
Okay then. I just wanted to make sure you knew that, because normally this time of night, boy, my phone is absolutely packed full of people that want to always talk to my guest, but I think tonight they're just so interested, they want to hear what you have to say. Now, when we get, I don't know, into the midnight hour, and if I have a whole bunch of calls, well, we'll start taking them, but I am so interested in all of this. We left off at climate, and I would love for you to pick up right there.
Yeah. So, I mean, who would imagine in 1922 that the poles, the caps, as you said, of the globe, will not be there?
Right.
I mean, why should he think of such a thing? What would have he to gain from saying such a lunatic thing?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, not even in their it wasn't even on the tip of the tongue. It wasn't in the zeitgeist of the culture at the time.
Exactly. Because you remember how the population escalated. The escalation of the population actually started after the conclusion of the World War II. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it doubled by 1970, and then it doubled again. But at the time, the population, the world population, was far less, and there were no such considerations at the time about the climate, because even though the Industrial Revolution, it was quite evident that it affects the climate, it's still the climate change and the climate problems were not evident at the time.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, and as they are today, at least. So let's move on to the communications thing now, because we talked about the food supply. In a moment where he's in his room, he has left out of the room, and then he comes back and he sees that he has a message on his phone. Okay, he has a phone. That's the only time he mentions about that phone. The funny thing about the phone is that there is a message for him, an automated message left for him by his loved one, Sylvia, who is talking to him in 3D, and he wants to kiss her, and wow, what beautiful lips he has, and how beautiful her blonde hair is falling down, and she's all alive in front of him, and he wants to kiss her. He wants to, you know, and she's leaving a message to him. Now, who would imagine that in 1922? And you know what? The new generation of phones that are smartphones that will come in 10 years from now will have that capability of being holographic. You will be able to be seeing a moving a three-dimensional holographic means. They are working on this right now. And he's talking about such a device in 1922. What a mind could make up such a thing.
Well, I'm still stuck on GMOs. How could a mind way back then have even thought of such a thing as genetically modified foods?
Which are made in the laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, and that is a reality for us now today, and we don't think much of it, except that we want to put Monsanto out of business. But that he was thinking of that at the time. I mean, I can really see now how the translator that you were talking about at the beginning of the night tonight was so taken by this story. I can see why you are so taken by the story. It's very easy to see once you start getting into it.
Let me make a forecast here that sooner or later you will call me again within the next year and you will ask me to go over the story again after you have read the book.
Oh,
you want to bet on this?
I guarantee that you are absolutely right about that. Oh, no, we have just gotten started with this, and I'm going to have a lot of questions. And I have the idea that tonight you're really giving as much as you can, but we're still scratching the surface of it, and that's all.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well.
So, since we talked about the communication means, let's talk about transportation. How do these people move on?
Yes.
How do they move from one place to another?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they fly. Now, they didn't have drones back in 1922, did they?
No.
But they do have Linsens in the future. Linsens are the small vehicles I told you about for one or two persons that are like flying little motorbikes, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They make no sound whatsoever. They are soundless. They have no emissions. And you actually don't even drive it. You tell it, I want to go to L.A., and they take you to L.A., okay?
That is great.
That's simple as that. And they park on their own. You don't really actually care about parking because it will go right at the open slot and put itself there. That's the small vehicles that people enjoy because they're, you know, it's like flying like birds. Mm. They feel the air.
And I imagine you don't own the vehicle. You probably just go to a place where there's a bunch of them and you just take one when you need one.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Okay.
Now, they have the big ones. Those are called Dunners. And they are like cigar-like planes. They have no wings. And they can host within them thousands of passengers and cargo. And also their individual Linsens. So I go with my Linsen inside the Dunner. I park it in the parking lot. And I fly with the Dunner. And they may cover huge distances in minutes. They go from continent to continent. And they have cinemas. They have places to stick around and play and enjoy. Amazing.
Sounds like a UFO, a cigar-shaped craft.
Well, if a UFO is actually a crack in the time-space continuum, then probably we are seeing Dunners. Some of the sightseeings of UFO sightings might be cracks of the space-time continuum where we see these things temporarily and then they disappear again. That's another explanation you could give to this, not only the ET thing. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has crossed my mind once or twice.
Yeah. It will cross more now. Now, they have also the classic auto routes, okay? They exist as well. But they are far different from what we have now. They have the bilvays. I'm talking with terminology of the future, okay? We don't have similar words. Bilvay is huge autostratus of the day with width of half a mile and length of several thousand miles. He says there that there is a road, bilvay, which starts from Porto in Portugal, and it goes all the way to Siberia to the other end, Vladivostok, all the way to, and thousands of miles of crossing the continent of Europe and Asia. So in these huge autostratas, they have the so-called rayoses. They are humongous, many-leveled buses that are moved by traction. Okay, they're like, he's explaining this, and he says it's like seeing the Empire State Building. It existed at his time. I think it was not Empire State. He says a skyscraper of New York in particular, but you bring it down, and that is how big this bus is. Okay, the Rayosa.
Wow, what a feat of engineering.
Yeah, and by the way, they don't have tires. It seems that all these vehicles are actually a little above the ground, about 1 to 2 feet above the ground, and they move with a very bizarre way. I mean, they don't touch the ground. It is as if the road is made of a specific. And actually it says it's crystal. It has some crystals, and it seems as if it has a force there that does not allow the gravity to let this humongous thing touch the ground. It moves over the ground.
Reminds me of the magnetic trains in Japan.
Exactly. Now they are doing this in Japan. I mean, imagine that. He always says that all the technological things that they use there were actually done in our times, in the barbarian times. All the breakthroughs, the technological breakthroughs, were done in our times. They are using this technology back in the future, okay? They use this technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's shocking how they move around because, you see, when he first came out of the hospital where he was residing, he was shocked and he was trying to hide because when he looked up in the sky, he was seeing all these flying machines of all sizes moving on the sky, and he was afraid they will fall down. He was afraid probably there is a bombardment or something.
Right, right. Is this an invasion? We're being invaded.
Yeah. He was so shocked by seeing all this flying, and he actually was seeing also floating cities all over the globe. And they are not only floating cities, they are also underground cities within the Earth. Wow. It seems again that they have been overpopulated again. They have a lot of population. He talks about the cities he visits, of cities of a lot of million of people. Mm-hmm. But they don't have a poverty problem. They don't have a scarcity problem. They do have all the goods and all the services that they want. That's the difference with today. But they are overpopulated. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, then that makes sense. You'd have to figure out some place for these people to live.
Yeah. So now, if we go to study their social structure and how everything is controlled, as I told you, in the year of 2396, they constituted the Universal Commonwealth, the new. They laid out the blueprint of how they are going to build the new society.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually updated and worked out by the Representative Collective Assembly, which is called Riksdag. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have political or judicial institutions.
Thank God. Oh, my gosh. It's about time.
They don't have lawyers. Can you imagine there are no lawyers there?
Sounds like paradise to me. No right, no left, no jobs and no lawyers and flying cars. Where do I sign? I want to go.
Okay. I have paper here. I will tell you how. They have... No criminal acts, no deviant behavior, no delinquency, no jails, no reformatory places.
A world without prisons.
And crime. No crime. Because, you see, they have developed in such a way, they have a social control embedded as an app, let's say, an application, through the internalizing and socializing the certain principles that they were built on. In other words, what is this saying of the great philosopher who said, do unto yourself...
Others as you would do to yourself.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay? And they respect the other human beings and the animals that are next to them. They respect the other people. So there is no need for social control in the terms of a penalty. Oh, now you did this and you will go for 3 years in prison, or you will pay such a fine. There is nothing like that.
Mm.
And this Swiss guy now is so astonished by this. And he says, This cannot be happening. You are fooling me. You are telling me lies. How can you tell me there is no crime? How can you tell me nobody is deviating? How can you tell me that everyone is happy?
Yeah, right. Well, when resources are available, you don't have the crime that we see today. Simple fact.
It seems that people realized that understanding that the living is good. You see, the whole thing is in our society is, why do you have more than I do?
Yes.
It all starts from there.
Yes.
Okay. So I become a thief to steal something from you. So I become a bit richer and you a little poorer. But the point is that when you don't have that, when you don't need that, you don't need to steal, you don't need to deviate because you're free, why should you do it?
Yeah. What laws do you have to break to meet your needs? They're met. Yeah.
When there is no discrimination about the color, about the age, about anything, why should you do anything that deviates from social norms?
Well, and this just occurred to me, you know, today in our barbaric world, committing crimes and getting away with it is almost a badge of honor, right? And also getting your hands on resources and getting those with criminal means and getting away with that is also a badge of honor. Look at D.B. Cooper. He's almost seen as a kind of a hero because he robbed as much money as he did and he got away with it. Well, I would think at this time it would be completely reversed. Why in the world would you ever want to take resources, the resources that are available to you? I would think it would be the exact opposite, that if you were to steal anything, of course, there is no stealing because everything's available to you, but they would look at that as, my God, what has mentally gone wrong with this person that they have committed such an act? You know, the social mentality is so flipped into a place that I would always hope mankind would go.
And if the story is true, it will go there. If the story is true, this will happen, fortunately. You know, we will undergo a lot of turmoils and a lot of bad things to see the next two centuries. So if you die, don't come back in the next two centuries. That is an advice for my audience here. Please try to avoid to be incarnated in the next two centuries. You're going to see terrible things happening.
After the year 2400, that's where you want to shoot for.
Exactly. That's the start. People still work a lot at the time. Eh? Let's not say that it is 2 years. For the first 1,000 years, people were working for 40 years, then for 30 years, then for 20 years. It gradually went down. You know, because technology was more efficient, and the more efficient technology was and the production outcome was more efficient, the more people were having spare time and free time. And they could relieve themselves from this.
Wow.
From this terrible cycle. So in terms of the social stratification I was talking, the people that are really valued over there are the officials of at the top of the intellectual and spiritual leadership. Okay? They are called the Lorphis. And then they are the Electus. And then they are the Tiltes. These, you know, are categories. We have no idea what they are.
Right.
He's describing this in the diaries. We are just as stupid people watching those, and we don't know what is happening. Then there is the Prästskab, which are priests and clergy. Priests are highly valued. And but they are not, I will explain after the break what the spiritual and religious cycle is.
Oh, I'm and so curious about that. After everything we've heard, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Then they are the office partners that work in the state offices, like public service today. You know, they do all the job, that administrative work that has to be done. And finally, they are the parvenus. They are the kivas that do not engage in altruistic services. Okay? They are only there to have fun. They go for vacation all day long. They do nothing. So they have very low prestige, the parvenus. I mean, nobody's blaming them. Nobody is telling them anything, but they don't have high esteem. On the contrary, Lorphis and Electus, because they devote themselves to spiritual matters and to the spiritual evolvement of humanity, they are highly regarded.
Well, it
and
makes...
they are given big estates, like, you know, huge estates with luxury sculpture and nice things and woven things from silk and beautiful robes. And they are really nicely dressed. And it's amazing.
Wow.
Amazing.
Well, then, yeah, we'll pick it up.
For hours.
Yeah, we'll pick it up right there when we come back. Also, another thing that makes sense to me is in the future, they would have their own descriptive terms. They would have their own terminology for the structure of their society as we do today. Again, we'll be right back. So here's what I want to do, and we never do this on the program, but I'll make an exception for tonight. So I know there's a couple of you that are on the line right now, and I want to give Nassos, our guest tonight, well, that's his nickname. Let me see if I can do this one more time. Athanasios Komianos. That's Komianos, sorry. That's not so easy. Anyhow, I want to give him another half an hour, and then we'll start taking your calls. How does that sound? Because we're about to head into another very interesting aspect of this story, and I'm sure there's a whole lot more to it, although there's one thing I want to clarify, and that is I'm getting a message here from Paul in the wormhole who's saying, hey, there's a lot of books on Amazon called Remembering the Future. Is that the right name? No, that is not the right name. Chronicles from the Future. And Nassos, what's the name of the author on that so people know the exact book to get?
He's a Greek guy. He's the editor of the book, the shortened version. And his name is Achilleas Syrigos.
All right. So that way, at least if they have the accurate name of the book and the author, then they'll know when they find the right one.
Yep.
All right. All right. Well, cool. Okay. So then let's get into it. We were going to talk about the spiritual structure of this time in the year 2,000 years ahead of us. It's just incredible. Yes. So go right ahead if you don't mind.
Well, after the stratification, I told you that the people who are involved with spiritual matters are highly regarded. People in general are free to exercise their religious feelings, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And wherever you go, there exist temples from all religions, everywhere. And you know what? They still have the pantheon from the Greek, ancient Greek deities. They do have such temples. They have from ancient Egypt temples. They still, some people go there for their spiritual expressions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just got a note here, just to make it easy for everyone. If you want to get the book that Nassos and I are talking about tonight, then we made it very easy for you. Just go to midnightinthedesert.com, click on Nassos' photo, and scroll down a little bit. You'll find it right there. So you don't really have to go out hunting for anything. Just go to midnightinthedesert.com.
And next to the Chronicles from the Future is my book as well, if they want to read it.
Yes, well, of course, of course. But this is very interesting. So you've got temples all over the world to every kind of religion. I would even think that some new religions would have sprung up as well.
It seems that Christianity has prevailed, even though today that may sound bizarre, because actually the fastest growing religion in the world right now is Muslim religion.
Is Islam.
It seems at the time that Christianity has prevailed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Christianity, not as we know it today, with these denomination things and these preaching things and trying to proselytize people, not in any way like this. He explains very clearly that it has nothing to do with what we know today. They have taken out all the editing from the scripts that took place back in the councils, 325 and 553, and all these councils of the church are taken out. They accept that the faith is a totally personal matter, and it can be expressed and experienced in a personal way, and there is no way anyone will involve in this. Okay?
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, and they kept the essence of Christianity. What is the essence? The principles of brotherhood, love, altruism, the act of forgiveness, mercy. You know, these are the basic
concepts. Charity, take care of your neighbor, all these sort of things, yes.
Yes, so this essence is kept there, as well as, but if you examine all of religions of today, if you examine them, you will realize that in essence, they all say the same in the core.
Mm-hmm.
What differs, it's the outside, okay? So what these people have done is kept the essence of all these insights from the religions, and they allow practice to everyone, and they can gather and participate in mass services and liturgies that do take place very often. Actually, Dinach, when he's in the body of Andreas Northam, he's describing how these people always move towards the sun, they turn towards the sun, and they pray, to the sun. And they do that on the sunset as well. They're very ceremonial. Not unlike us. They are very. They give a lot of attention to rituals
And tradition, keeping traditions and, alive.
Yes, and they respect each other in such a way that there is no way you can have a fight. So I don't know. Do you know what the word religion means?
The word religion, the actual dictionary definition.
Yes.
I'll answer you honest. I don't think I do.
Okay. It comes from the Latin word, which means religio. Religio is bond. That is the essence of religion. It is the bonding of each other with each other.
Mm. Wow. You know, when you distill it down to that definition, it sure does simplify everything and all the complexities and devaluing of other religion, because that doesn't seem right to me. That all seems to fall away. It's just
exactly.
a bond. I like that.
Yeah. You can look it up. That's the etymology of this particular word. But would we want to speak for something more interesting?
Sure.
Would you like to speak? Like sexual sure. mores and practice?
Why not?
Maybe.
Yes. Okay. I just had this funny feeling I needed to give you some more time because I had a feeling you had things up your sleeve there.
So let me get it out of my sleeve now.
All right.
Now, marriage as we know it today is non-existent.
Oh.
It doesn't exist. Youngsters are strongly discouraged to have any sexual encounter before they have concluded their duty to the service, to the state. Okay,
and they actually abide by that?
You have to refrain, you have to restrain yourself. You should not involve yourself in erotic ways. Okay?
Oh, okay.
That does not mean that you're going to be punished if you do so. Some exceptions exist, indeed, and some youngsters cannot control themselves, but most do. So after they become civis, the citizens, they can freely engage in any relationship, and actually most of them do have sexual intercourse during the first night of becoming civis. They have a party there, and they do engage in sexual intercourse. But the interesting thing about it is this, that for our 20th century Swiss guy, these people in the future seem so far more naive than we are today. Actually, in the beginning of the 20th century. They do not indulge in sexual intercourse unless there is a very strong feeling of love connecting them with their mate.
Oh.
So they are really as adolescent love. You know, it's like a love that is preserved very highly and considered very highly. They don't allow the body to take over, but they allow the spirit to take over instead. This may sound very strange for us now, today, but this is how it is described. What they are waiting for, all the young people at the time, is the so-called Liebwirch, is another term of the time, which is a candid, gentle, without self-interest love. Okay? This love is a reflection of another thing, the Samith. The Samith is the source of everything. It is the transcendent reality, the what overwhelms us all. It is quite big and overwhelming. The Samith is what we today call God in the West. We call God. It's far more than that. It is, you know, including everything that exists. It's the essence of things. So the Liebwirch, the love between two persons, is a reflection of the Samith. You have to really have the thirst and nostalgia for the fine, the pure, the essence, to be able to engage in a relationship with a person.
Wow.
Does that make any sense, or is it...
Oh, it absolutely makes sense. It makes sense to me, because that's what I wish we were doing today. This is something, Nasos, that really concerns me, and I've never had the chance to talk about it. Of course, it never comes up in the course of conversation on the program, and I know people make jokes about me because I see them. Yes, I see what you write online, and people speculate, well, what's the matter with her? She's single. What's the matter with you? You don't have a family, you know, don't have a husband and all of that. Yeah, there's a reason for that, because there's not a whole lot of value placed on love and relationships. It's looked at as something trivial. People are looked at as disposable, almost. And
exactly.
You can enter into an agreement with somebody, and it's okay, you know, what, 6 months later, when it gets old for you, to just dump that person and move on for whatever reason that's convenient for you at the time. And because of that, I don't even want to play ball. You know, unless it's something real, I don't even want to bother. I don't want to go through the heartache. Don't want to have to survive something like that again. And that makes for a lot of single people in our day today. And the way social media is the way our communications are structured today, we're isolated. We become isolated. In fact, even shopping online isolates us, because you're not even going to go out your house to the store anymore, and have
you don't
the chance,
expose yourself anymore, yes.
Right? To meet somebody,
you don't interact.
Right. You don't get a chance to interact, and when you do, can you trust that person? I don't know if I can trust that person. I see all kinds of examples around of reasons why I shouldn't trust anybody. But love isn't valued in our time, and I'd love for someone to prove me wrong on that, but it just doesn't seem like it. And I mean collectively, it just doesn't seem to have a high value.
I agree. I cannot do anything else but I agree with you on this.
Wow.
On the contrary, it seems up there in the future things are not that way, and people have feelings for the other person. But they are not obliged to stay with their mate forever. They can always change.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They can always fall in love with another person. That's very human. But they have to immediately announce that the partner expects, hey, Heather, I fell in love with another lady.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you tell me, you announce it, and you go.
Aha, okay. And that's accepted.
Yeah, it is accepted, and it can happen many times. And sincerity and clarity are expected in the relationship, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, that's the case.
So no secrets.
finally two people decide that they're ready to have offspring, they submit their request to the Office of Statistics. They cannot just make love and have a child. They have to submit their wish to the Office of Statistics. And when they give them permission, it usually takes about a year for this to happen. They then can have a child.
And how is that decision made? Does he describe that at all? What is studied about the people in order to decide, you know, do they get to have a child? Or are people ever denied having a child?
No. It's only a matter of time.
Oh, okay.
They make sure that this person is going to be able to have all the goods. You know, they have to make sure that the population is kept under control.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So it's
not reached to the limits, the planet again.
Okay, so it's a formality and a precautionary measure so that we don't repeat past mistakes.
Exactly.
Got you. Okay.
So now, you know, we all go to the gym here. We exercise. We do things. Another interesting thing is that these people do have physical fitness. They have swimming pools, they have centers, they have all kinds of sports. But they have such a sluggish temperament and lack of any fighting motives so that they despise the chase of records. They have no prizes for the winners. Actually, they have no winners whatsoever. So all the spirit of the Olympic Games and the ancient Greek thing that there is only one winner and that's it and there's only one collapses totally. There is nothing like it. People can exercise, they can swim, they can do whatever, but they do it in another manner. So that fits with the society because there is no competition as it is today. You know,
oh, man, no more football.
Yeah. No boxing, no such things, no violence.
Huh? Wow.
So it all fits together if you think about it. All these things, because you see, you don't see them linearly as I present them to you right now. For me to fish all this information and put it in this order, it took me years of reading this book again and again to manage to put them in this order. Now, if you read this book, you will get different conclusions and you will make different connections, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Yes, yes, sure.
So let's talk about the most important development in that new era, okay? And that's the most important thing your listeners have to learn from this whole thing. That after years of meditational practices, you see, they had, in this era, they have a lot of spiritual centers.
Mm-hmm.
We have ashrams today, we have, you know, certain spiritual centers. And at that time, people are over-encouraged to meditate a lot, to develop spiritual abilities and sometimes paranormal abilities. And there are about 200 centers throughout the globe that are working into this direction for many years, for hundreds of years, actually, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it so happens that after years of meditational practices, there comes a shift in human consciousness. That changes the world. And all these New Age guys now today, they're talking about the shift. It's not going to come. It's coming at that time. It's very far away in the future. It's 15 centuries ahead of us.
Wow.
And that is called the oversinance. It is the ability to transcend the senses, the ability to oversee things. So there is a practitioner at the Ederson Institute. Ederson Institute is one of these many hundreds of institutes that are studying the consciousness. And that man, who is now 70 years old, Alexis Volkey, managed to make the breakthrough by extending the abilities of the human mind. That was on the 6th of September of 30, 382. Oh, my God, it's September. Oh, no, it's 7 September today. No, it's 6 September to you there.
Yes,
right?
It is. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is.
That's a coincidence. That's something to think about.
And we were talking about synchronicities like that just Monday night. But it sounds like what you're describing is the actual human achievement of something like enlightenment or something close to enlightenment.
Exactly. It's called supervision, and this acquisition of the new conceptual properties becomes a reality at this very day, the 6th of September of the year 3382.
3382. Humanity reaches enlightenment.
Their year is 986, but our year is 3382, so it's about... How many centuries from now? Many centuries, as I see. It's at least...
I think 14.
14 centuries, yes. So you can imagine what happened then. It's amazing because in the next 36 hours, this structural shift that happened in Alexis Volkey's brain started happening to other people as well. Do you remember the theory of the 100 monkey?
Yes, you read my mind. You took it. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Huh? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened. Supervision became a common thing. It started spreading out, and it became far. It is something far greater than intuition, clairvoyance, or prophetic vision. You know, it has nothing to do. It is more than that. It is the immediate enlightenment.
Yeah, if someone doesn't... Yeah, enlightenment is... true enlightenment is quite an interesting state of consciousness. And if a person out there doesn't know what that is, I encourage you to go out there, look it up, and start reading about it.
Yeah. And this enlightenment, this supervision is added upon the other mental, spiritual qualities of human beings, you know. No, intuition, precognition, and all this is added upon. And what it is actually the immediate knowledge and the direct communion with the Lys. The Lys is light in their language, okay? So when we say when have a near-death experience, a person went to the light and came back, or we see that during a regression session when people go to the light and that's where they stay before they come incarnated again, that's the light he's talking about. But people can now see it when they are fully conscious. They don't have to go through a session or through a near-death experience to witness this thing. So what is Nibelwich? Is the new ability acquired by Volkey. And what were once considered metaphysical or transcendental experiences are from now on within the realm of the positive scientific understanding of that time.
That is an incredible breakthrough. I mean, no. That I've had a near-death experience. And
you did?
Yes, and I don't want anybody out there to die, but I so do wish more people could have that experience without their life being in danger, because it would be such a different world. I mean, it truly would be, you would not recognize this world if more people had that experience, and this is achievable through meditation, through enlightenment. That is amazing. I'm almost at a loss for words. You've knocked me back in my chair plenty of times, but that takes it, Nassos. That is amazing. Wow.
It's a mind-bending experience, I tell you, and because I always believe that people can extend their abilities and they should not think of themselves so limited. All this story is like putting this meaning into life, you know. It's like putting things together. It's the glue that binds things together.
Yes. No, absolutely. I this is so astonishing. I really need to search for words to tell you exactly how I feel about all that. I mean, this is one of the most incredible things I've ever heard in my life. We got to take another break here. And we can talk some more when we come back. But we're going to have you, Nasos. You're going to have to come back on so we can talk about this some more. And we will start taking calls when we come back from this break. And I want to know from you what your reaction is to everything you've heard tonight. Well, we can wait no longer. We just cannot wait one more minute. It is that time. Time for you to get your telephonic device, manipulate it, make your way here to this program, because I want to hear your reactions. I want to hear your reactions to what you've heard tonight, and of course, any questions you may have from my guest. Now, let me see if I can do this. Athanasios Komianos. Oh, practice makes perfect. All right, so get on the phone, and you won't have to wait any longer. I mean, that's why I said something a while back, earlier in the evening, because I just didn't want you on hold, waiting, getting bored, falling asleep. So get into the program now. You can call on Skype. If you have Skype on your device and you're in North America, then search for MITD11. And if you're not in North America, then try MITD21 for those of you not in Canada, the United States, or Mexico. Other than that, all of our phone numbers Art has been kind enough to give out all night long. And you're welcome to use those to call into the program. And if you haven't gotten it, I mean, I can remind you one more time, the public number, probably the best number to try first, 1-952-225-5278. And, of course, first-time caller line, 775-285-5800. And I am anxious to hear from all of you. And, you know, I want to bring Nasos back. Welcome back, Nasos. As I'm listening to this, the big thing I'm getting out of it is that we approach something resembling a maturity, and that there is a hope for mankind, and that means that I'm buying it hook, line, and sinker. It sounds very, very true to me. But you've spent so many years steeped in this material. After all of it, what's your take on all of it? If you step back and look at the big picture.
Listen, I used up all my mental resources for this, because, you know, it was such a mind-bending experience going through these pages that my critical faculties were challenged again and again and again. My knowledge of physics, my knowledge of the human consciousness, the understanding of how things work. It was quite a challenge. But you see, it is. It seems to me that this is a very, very true story. People have criticized me because I've become public with this, and even some people have told me, how did you dare to say such things, and this is really not good for you, and you are risking your profession, and you're ridiculing your profession. No, I'm not doing anything. Actually, Professor Papahadzis, who was the vice president of the Supreme Court of Greece and the dean of the University of Pantheon University of Athens, was devastated because he dared to publish this book. Okay, but he was the one to really receive all the criticism. Mm-hmm. And in front of him, I'm nothing compared to prestige, but I'm taking this risk because I think this is really true. The story we are sharing here tonight has happened and will happen, because everything happens right now that we are talking. Everything is already happened.
Yes,
you know, it's like a déjà vu feeling. You know?
Well, yes, it is.
But it's a long deja vu, that's all. It has already happened. Do you remember the cave of Plato, that allegory of the cave from Plato's Republic? Are you aware of this story from the great Greek philosopher Plato?
Are you? No.
Do you remember that in school?
I think I might have forgotten it.
To our audience. You know, Plato is actually saying that we humans are thrown down here and we are like slaves captured in a cave, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we live in the cave, and when people walk away outside from the cave, we see their shades moving on the wall in front of us because we are tied in the cave. Okay, and that's what the world we think is. But if we were to unlock one of this person and let him out of the cave, and if that person were to see the real world and the sunshine and the forests outside and the beauty, and he were to come back to his fellow humans in the cave to describe the reality, what would they say?
They'd all want to go.
No, they would say he's crazy first. That's what they would all want to go, but they wouldn't believe him.
Oh.
You get my point.
Oh, my God, yes.
So you had a near-death experience. You saw the spiritual realm. You saw the other side of the tunnel. But when you came back, you realized that you couldn't share your story because the people are trapped. They are blinded.
Yeah.
They wear blindfolds.
You're right.
And it's... And what this guy is saying in the future is that people finally break their chains from this reality and they have the ability to see the real world. Because the real world is the world of ideas, as Plato was saying. It is up there. It's not down here. It is up there. This is part of the real world. It's not the real world. But at that time, all people know it, contrary to our time, that we are considered, how do you say people who are naive and stupid and easy believers?
Gullible.
How do you say that? Call them?
Gullible.
Gullible, bravo. That's the word. No, that's not the case. The case is that's the reality, and some people have the ability to see it, and some do not.
Well, I got to tell you something. Here's another message that I've gotten into the wormhole tonight before we grab our first call. This is from Retta in Oregon, and she said, "Thank Knossos for the most fascinating 3.5 hours I have ever experienced." And then here's another one from Michael. "Yes, I'm enjoying just listening tonight. This is awesome and a great listen." So that's a feedback that we're getting from a lot of people. And let's find out what they think on the phones here. I have really shortened our phone time on the program tonight. But and by the way, Nasos, this is totally unscreened. We don't even screen the calls around here. We just go for it. So I have idea what's about to happen. So we'll go right to the phone, and you're on the air with Knossos Komianos. We'll just do it that way. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Hello, Knossos. I have a couple questions, but first, Heather, I have to apologize to you. For the last couple nights, I took you to bed with me and fell asleep before I could ask any questions.
Oh, is that why? Are you my phantom callers?
Yeah. Probably. So, you're
well, that's okay. All right. All is forgiven. All is forgiven.
Thank you, Heather. I have a couple questions. You mentioned the ice caps are all gone in the future, correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay, haven't we suffered a great loss of landmass during that time?
There is only a brief mentioning of this. You know, he is not really, he's just pointing out that there are, because he is flying over and he sees there are no poles, and they tell him there are no poles anymore, and they tell him that there are no deserts anymore because everything is cultivated. And what has been mentioned more times than once is that it seems that everywhere, everything is air-conditioned. Everything is moderated. The climate is moderated in a technological way, which we cannot understand. So the picture that is given to us is very short to make a statement from this. Mm-hmm. If I answer your question, that's all I can say.
Okay.
Can you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you.
Yes.
Second question is, a lot of sea creatures and wildlife depend on those ice caps. Are we to think that they're all extinct, the wildlife and sea creatures that depend on the ice caps?
Yeah, there would be no polar bears, no penguins, unless they're in zoos.
Well, imagine that there was also in 2309 a nuclear disaster that almost destroyed everything. So I'm sure the ecosystem found a way to adjust itself, but we have no idea how this adjustment took place and what species have survived. What he is specifically saying is that there are huge pipes from the Atlantic Ocean that are ringing in some raw material, maybe. I don't know what that raw material is, but it's brought in and it's used for energy production. Again, no specificities.
One more time. I'm sorry, the Skype cut out for just a second. What was the last couple of words you said?
That a huge pipeline is bringing in from Atlantic Ocean to Europe a huge amount of some prime material that we have no idea what it is, but it is used in the Glothners.
Ah, that's the word. Okay, all right.
Yeah. Well, but we have no idea what that is. So
right,
I really don't know what happened to the species that could not survive. In the, probably they disappeared or probably they managed to adapt. I have no idea. Sorry for not being very good question that you asked.
Yeah, it's a very good question. But if you do think about the nuclear winter that would have had to have taken place, that would also have a significant effect on existing life on the planet. So I hope that answers your question. Next.
We pretty much have to depend on basically probably a lot of new creatures have come to in place by that time, even though many have become extinct. There's many new ones that have replaced them. Also, I saw a lot of similarities earlier in the program between Star Trek and Star Wars. It's almost like maybe those two programs pulled a lot of information from this book.
Could have, you know, very well could have, but keep in mind.
No, because that book was not available in the English language till last year, and the book in Greek was extinct. So there was no way that the producers of this film had access to this knowledge. It seems to me almost impossible. I cannot exclude it, but it seems almost impossible for them to have known this.
Mm-hmm. It would, yeah. The timelines there just don't work out. But we do know from other guests that I've talked to on the program that Gene Roddenberry was getting information from some pretty high ups. I guess my cognitive resources are also being depleted tonight. Gene Roddenberry was getting some information from people pretty high up in the military that knew about secret space programs and space travel and this sort of thing. But this information, he would not, I don't think, have had access to. Like you said, the story's been buried by the Masons.
Yes.
And I appreciate the call very much. Let me see here. Next on the phone, you're on the air with Nasos Komianos. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Heather. Good evening, sir. I don't really want to try to pronounce your name.
Don't even try.
My question was kind of like what Heather kind of briefly covered there for a minute. Is there any developments in space? Do we colonize Mars? Is there anything of that nature in your readings or the information you have, or are we just basically an Earth-based society?
You must have tuned in late because we did cover that, but go right ahead.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's a good question. Nasos?
Well, as we devoted some time on this, people managed to migrate Mars, and the recorded date for this was 2204. There was a massive transference of population to Mars. So probably that's where, the beginning of migrations is recorded. But unfortunately, this experiment didn't last more than 60 years because there was a collapse of the ecosystem in Mars, because it was a controlled ecosystem by the humans. It was created by the humans and it was destroyed. And more than 20 million people died there. Mm-hmm. In 2265, and only a few hundreds made it back to Earth to report the disaster. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there was migration, but from there on, humans realized that this is our planet, this is where we stay, we don't do any attempt to move from Earth anymore. That's what we have.
Did you have any other questions, Mike?
Just one. I wanted to ask about cloning in the future. If we took DNA from, say, today's time, could a person be cloned in the future? Not necessarily with the same memories or any of that, but basically take someone from this time and transfer their DNA to the future of, time capsule, whatever, and clone them at that point.
Hmm.
Yeah, a very interesting and good question. In this society is not so ego-centered. Actually, it seems that this society in the future has more care for the others than for self. So there is no need for cloning. You don't consider your DNA body better than the other, and you don't want to perpetuate this. So it seems there is no need for such a thing to happen. It may happen. There's no mention whatsoever in the book.
But what with the overpopulation issues, why clone people? You've got a lot of people already that you're trying to deal with. And I would imagine, we're talking about the tens of billions. If you have floating cities and people underground and all of that, then you've got a lot of people. And so why clone more of them if you're already dealing with more than you can handle?
I thoroughly agree with you.
Just a thought on that. Well, thank you very much for the call, Mike. They're still pretty good questions, and we'll probably be able to squeeze in another here. Back to the phone. You're on the air with Nasos Komianos. Welcome to the show.
Yes, Heather.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. This is James. I called last night. And, he really had a lot of things on the head. And I'd like to talk about agape love, the love of God. And I've been celibate for the last 20 years. And I would like to say that the futuristic version of love is so spiritual to me, and I've written so many songs for the Lord. how does he feel that we could achieve that in this day and age?
In this age?
Yes.
Am I understanding correctly?
Yes. He's referring to the discussion of marriage and relationships that we had there a little bit ago, and how can we have that today?
How could we have that today? That's a good question. Do you have another one? I wish we could. I think we are way too complex as humans, and we live in a society where money is valued, power is valued, things are valued, and not love is valued. I mean, of course, there are exceptions, like probably yourself, where you value love and sharing, and but there are other people who do not value this thing. And so long as we live in a competitive environment where I'm trying to be better than you, but the better is not better, spiritually speaking, but better it means better off, then we have a problem.
Yes. Yeah. I'd have to agree with you, Nasos, on that. Maybe on an individual level. Maybe if you're very lucky, you'll run into that one individual in our time, 2017 today, who also values love the way it ought to be valued. But we live in a time where ego and prestige are much more important, and who you're with, who you have a relationship with, also affects your prestige points, if you will. And so if you what's the phrase I hear over and over again? Well, I can find somebody better. You know, because people are disposable in our day and age. And so if you are with someone, you meet somebody else who also seems to like you and would offer you more prestige, maybe they have a, maybe they're famous, maybe they're rich, maybe whatever, you can just dump the person who's not as prestigious and get with this other person, and that's kind of how things are done in our time. I would think only on an individual basis could that be done. It's not a collective understanding that we have nowadays. It just isn't.
And do not misunderstand me. I never said there is monogamy in the future. Don't confuse one is with a specific person for a specific time. As long as this relationship lasts, it's wonderful. But there is no monogamy in that sense that, you know, we are not pigeons. We are humans. And humans are not monogamic. By definition. And it seems in the future they just respect, you know, they're not, as you said, disposable beings. Let's make another sex partner and another one and another one and another one. No, it's not that case. But it's certainly not monogamous on the other hand.
Right. And they don't keep secrets from each other, in that if somebody's cheating, you explain that, well, no, that means you've fallen in love with somebody else and you have to tell the person that you're with, and it might be painful, but they're okay with that. And then they say, well, I'm going off to be in this other relationship now. And that, to me, is, again, a signal of maturity.
Exactly.
You know, emotional maturity collectively in the human race, which is an amazing thing to know that we even get to that point. Even if it's 2,000 years from now, I'm encouraged, I'm encouraged to hear that we even get to that point at all. You know,
yeah.
It's amazing. How do I talk about your name? How do I pronounce your website, Nasos?
My website is, in English, we would say hypnoscopesis.
Got you. Okay.
It's a term that I have defined and I have coined, which means looking within. It's a technique, looking within through hypnosis.
Well, we're going to have to do another show just on that.
You would be thrilled by that. It's far even more interesting than the story you're listening now. I tell you.
Another profound statement. Well, I mean, if you would put up with it, my God, I can think already of two more shows we could do and a whole lot more. I mean, this was so interesting tonight. I thank you for taking the time to tell us this story. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to get the book, Chronicles from the Future. I am going to have to read it, take notes, and then get in touch with you and see what we can do after that, how many questions I have, and see if we can talk about it again. Because this is...
I would be happy to do so.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, this is one of the greatest stories nobody's ever heard of.
Yes.
And that's what I am always, always looking for. We are completely out of time, and I want to thank everybody who did call in. But Nasos, is there anything that you want to plug while we've got the time here at the end of the program?
No, my dear, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your patience with this story, and I'm sure we are going to come back and have another show on this.
Oh, we certainly are, and I want to talk to you about your website and everything that there is to do with that. I understand you coined that term, so we've got some more talking to do, and I look forward
I'm
to
sure.
it. I want to wish you the rest of your day, the rest of your morning is a good one, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me over.
Absolutely. See if
have
I can
a nice sleep.
Do this one more time here. That was Athanasios, let me see if I can do this again. Athanasios, there we go. Athanasios Komianos. one of my favorite people he has become just in the course of tonight, listening to him. What a fascinating story. The book Chronicles from the Future. And you can find that right at midnightinthedesert.com. You don't have to go searching for it. A lot to think about. And I will join you once again tomorrow night. Good night.
And we're listening. Ooh, we're listening.